You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening here.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
They have now refined these systems and the way to organize and manage them so that the Phoenix model can be perfectly applied anywhere around the world. And the CIA, it actually has created 10, 15, 20 of these Phoenix-style centers around the world and is now organizing itself in this manner so it can more perfectly coordinate with military forces and the State Department in countries where it's fighting this war on terror.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Douglas Valentine. Today's show, Phoenix as the model for homeland security and the war on terror. Douglas Valentine is the author of several works of historical nonfiction, including The Phoenix Program about the CIA in Vietnam and The Strength of the Wolf and the Strength of the Pack, which discuss the history of federal drug law enforcement. He also edited a poetry anthology with Our Eyes Wide Open, Poems of the New American Century. His latest book is The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World. Today we discuss the Phoenix program in Vietnam, how systems analysis was used to implement the program, and how the Phoenix model is still in use today. Douglas Valentine, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Your book, The Phoenix Program, America's Use of Terror in Vietnam, was originally published in 1990, but trashed by a review in the New York Times by Morley Safer, who'd been a reporter in Vietnam. You have written that the book was killed because it said that Phoenix never would have succeeded if the reporters in Vietnam hadn't covered for the CIA. Your book, The Phoenix Program, America's Use of Terror in Vietnam, has now been published online by the Forbidden Bookshelf series. With regard to the war in Vietnam in general, your book paints a very complex picture of the bureaucratic structures of both the civilian and military components and their interfaces with each other. A constantly shifting chain of command, personnel, programs, strategies, tactics. It was impossible for me to track it all. The whole enterprise reads like a god-awful mess, even apart from the incredible violence and carnage of that war, and the Phoenix program in particular. In your book, you mention organizational reforms that paved the way for Phoenix. What were you referring to?
It helps to have a little history. So, you know, to put it in context, like you said, it's a very big subject. And just let me lead up to how it all came to be. It'll only take a minute or two. But as your listeners may know, the United States first intervened in Vietnam in around 1954, 1955, when the country was divided in half. And the great powers of the world were going around dividing up countries all over the world at the time. Korea got divided up. A lot of countries got divided up. And the North went to what were called the Communists under Ho Chi Minh, and the South went to the United States, which installed a puppet president named Diem. Diem was a Catholic, and he did not have widespread support via Vietnam, was 95% Buddhist. So by 1963, it was evident that the Americans could not gain any political, real political support in South Vietnam with Diem as president. So the CIA bumped them off in 1963. They allowed a cabal of South Vietnamese generals to knock off Diem. And they put in a cabal of Buddhist generals, and they thought this would help gain support of the rural population for the American presence in South Vietnam. And they began really waging a counterinsurgency against the rural population. It was very intense. And the CIA was leading that effort to pacify the South Vietnamese population and make them support the South Vietnamese government, which did not represent any of their interests, but that was the struggle that the CIA was facing at the time. And they put a lot of programs in place, which were called pacification programs. They set up a secret interrogation center in each of South Vietnam's 44 provinces. And they created what were called counter-terror teams in every province, which would go off and hunt the supporters of the Viet Cong. And they set up what were called armed propaganda teams, which would go into the villages and try to propagandize people. And they also set up in 1964 a lot of sort of Stalinist tribunals. Some of them were military and some of them were civilian, in which anybody who didn't actively support the South Vietnamese government could be tried on national security charges without any evidence and sent to jail, sent to prison. So they put all these programs, the CIA put all these programs in place. And in 1965, the United States government sent the military in because the war still wasn't going very well. And when the United States military arrived, it was, you know, hundreds of thousands of soldiers were fighting. North Vietnamese troops had now started to infiltrate along the Ho Chi Minh trails, coming into mostly the northern and central parts of South Vietnam. But by 1966, the United States realized it still did not have the support of the South Vietnamese citizenry, which was overwhelmingly supporting what was called the National Liberation Front. The Americans had the support of, you know, the bourgeoisie, which was in the cities, but out in the countryside, they did not have the support of the people. So in late 1966, the White House told the CIA to create what was called a General Staff for Pacification. And they did this secretly. And by the summer of 1967, the CIA had created this General Staff for Pacification, which combined all of the CIA programs that it was conducting in the countryside and in the cities with all the U.S. military programs and all the State Department programs, all the South Vietnamese programs which were involved in pacification. And that was called the Phoenix Program. The Phoenix Program was based on what you referred to earlier, systems theory, systems analysis. The idea was to coordinate all these many systems which were in place in South Vietnam and which were designed to pacify the South Vietnamese population. And they did this secretly, and they created this secret organization called Phoenix, which had, apart from its mission of coordinating some 25 or 30 different ongoing programs in South Vietnam, but it had the overall purpose of pacifying the South Vietnamese civilians. And that pacifying them meant either coercing or enticing them to support the government. And if they didn't support, off to jail they went, and no trial necessary. And the other part of Phoenix was what was called an attack on the Viet Cong infrastructure. This was the part of the Phoenix that's most known to people, the assassination squads, the torture centers. Through a nationwide network of informants, the CIA ran what was called the Hamlet Informant Program, in which the police established informants in every village, in every district, in every province in South Vietnam that they could. And those informants would inform on any civilian who was in any way sympathetic to the National Liberation Front. Those names, people would be brought into the interrogation centers. They'd be worked over. They'd be made to inform. They'd be made to turn into double agents. And if they didn't, off to the security court they went, or they took them out back and shot them. And once they had the names of the people, and these are civilians, the civilian members who are secretly supporting the National Liberation Front. These are not soldiers. This is a woman who works in the Women's Liberation Unit, or somebody who's a courier, or somebody who's currying rice to Viet Cong guerrilla units. It was all civilians. Once they had identified these people, they would send out the CIA's hit teams, which were called counterterror teams. And the military lent support. The military provided most of the people that worked for the Phoenix program. It was always under CIA direction. And in the early years, it was largely staffed in the provinces by the CIA, but it was always under CIA direction. But once the majority of the people that worked for the Phoenix program were military people who were detailed to the CIA, and there was hundreds and thousands of these people, plus there were thousands and thousands of South Vietnamese secret policemen. There were thousands of these armed propaganda teams, of hit teams. It was just a massive, massive undertaking. It was secret for the first 2 years, but it all relied on very sophisticated theories of it was computerized, highly sophisticated theories of organization and management, which is why when the person who was detailed to create the Phoenix program was a guy I interviewed at length. His name was Nelson Brickell. He was a graduate from Yale. He was considered an organizational genius. And he described at length to me, and it's in the book, how he actually used models from Ford Motor Company and businesses, big corporations, in order to streamline and bureaucratize, which was essentially a system of political repression in South Vietnam. If you don't do what we want, either you get killed or you go to jail. And that's one of the best explanations I can give you about the Phoenix program. Of course, it's much more. It relies very much on corruption, on giving the South Vietnamese policemen an incentive to coerce and to bribe and extort South Vietnamese citizens. And it was done on a massive scale. And the whole idea was to give the policemen and the people who were collaborating with the United States a free hand to make money off this program. Otherwise, they wouldn't have done it, just like CIA allowed its generals and its politicians to import and sell heroin and other drugs in South Vietnam. They incentivized this program, and essentially it was they gave the police and the military a free hand to extort the people, and just totally fractures the society as a way of being able to either intimidate or coerce or entice somebody into working for the South Vietnamese government. And of course, it didn't work. The people resisted. Resisted in very heroic ways. And there's a lot of revisionist history about the Vietnam War now. And Phoenix is being touted as something that was actually very successful because it knocked off so many people. The program is estimated between 1967 and 1971 to have killed through it. So the Phoenix assassination team, some 30,000 people. The South Vietnamese put the figure at 40,000. My own estimate is that those are way off, and hundreds of thousands of people were killed. Hundreds of thousands of people were sent to prison through these Stalinist tribunals, which relied totally for evidence on the testimony of an anonymous informant who would just say, you know, well, that guy over there stole something from me, so now I'm going to inform, you know, or his dog pooped on my lawn, so now I'm going to say he's a sympathizer for the Viet Cong, and then off to jail the guy would go, and he wouldn't even be able to appear in court to defend himself. It was that horrible of a situation. And nevertheless, a lot of revisionist historians now are sort of overlooking those details and saying it was a very successful program. And it has indeed served as the model nowadays for the war on terror and as a model for the Department of Homeland Security in terms of systems theory.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Douglas Valentine. Today's show, Phoenix as the Model for Homeland Security and the War on Terror. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. Was the Phoenix program in effect all through the war up until the end of the Vietnam War, or did they ever end it?
No, it went through a couple of different manifestations, but it never ended. I have seen telegrams in a Freedom of Information Act request as late as 1975 talking about how, you know, the Phoenix program was still in effect. There was a negotiated ceasefire. This is at the end of 1972. And the villages that were actually supporting the National Liberation Front would actually start waving, their flag. And according to CIA officers I talked to, this just made it easier now for them to send their Phoenix teams out there and knock these people off, because now they were no longer secret. They were just advertising themselves. And that's one of the reasons that the ceasefire failed. Just like all these ceasefires that the United States is negotiating in Syria or wherever always seem to fail because, like all the treaties that negotiates, it never abides by them. And the greatest method for not abiding by any of these treaties is that the CIA is always behind the scenes operating in secret and trying to undermine them. And all the press corps, whether it's in Syria now, Iraq now, Afghanistan now, or back in South Vietnam during the war, all the national security correspondents, the press corps, know exactly what's going on, but they have a deal with the CIA. If they want to keep having access to the plans and strategies and programs that the CIA is clandestinely operating in that country, they have to keep their mouths shut. And if some national security correspondent gets moralistic about it, well, his editor and his publisher will fire him, send him off to Siberia. So it really is no distinction between the press and the CIA. These are the same people, the same class of people, and they have the same exact interests, and they have the same exact filters for making sure that nobody who is ideologically can't be assimilated is dispensed with and never gets into that club. And again, these things have been solidified in America through the kind of organizational geniuses and management structures that were used to create the Phoenix program. These people are adept at creating the social structures and the political structures that keep us repressed. And they do the same thing in the United States that they do overseas. And I had the added advantage of being able to talk to close to 100 CIA officers who were involved in the Phoenix program. And they thought that William Colby, who was at one time the director of Central Intelligence and was the CIA officer most associated with the Phoenix program, he had actually liked my idea for a book and it helped me and it introduced me to a lot of these CIA officers. And they spoke openly to me. So even though it's a difficult subject to understand, and even though talking about systems management assumes that you have a capacity to understand how a lot of different systems are being juxtaposed, and that's difficult, and it's off-putting to a lot of people. But if you really want to understand how it goes, you have to spend the time trying to learn about it. You can't understand the petrochemical industry in a day. You know, I mean, these things take a lot of serious study, and the Phoenix program was written with that in mind. That book that came out in 19 was that it would be a serious study that people would have to really spend a lot of time looking at in order to understand the complexities of political repression and social repression. It's not something that you can just say, well, Donald Trump's a billionaire and of course he's going to do it. You really got to understand the intricacies of it if you want to unravel it.
I can certainly appreciate the complexity of it after looking at your book on the Phoenix program. You have mentioned that the Phoenix program was run by the CIA, and the CIA is considered a civilian organization rather than a military one. And you've already pointed out that of course, they worked together to implement the Phoenix program in Vietnam. That's a very complex interaction. With regard to the war on terror, homeland security, but specifically the Phoenix program in Vietnam, how would you analyze who had the upper hand? In your book, you've pointed out that the most important thing about counterterror was collecting intelligence. That was the most important thing. So did that make CIA structure really more important than the military?
Yeah, in a word. Because each of these two organizations, you know, the Pentagon and the Department of Defense on the one hand, has a mandate, a congressional mandate. The military even has its own judicial system. It's a huge, immense society that exists somewhat apart, but parallel to civilian American society. And historically, the military at the highest levels is commanded by civilians. The president is a civilian, and he is the commander in chief. And historically, the United States has thought that in order to preserve democratic institutions, civilians have to manage the military. And so there's this presumption in a country like South Vietnam that the U.S. Embassy will be aware of everything that the military is doing. And the ambassador in any country will exercise control over the military. The military can't decide on its own to go into Hemlan provinces in Afghanistan and start blowing up villages. They have to get their okay from the embassy and also from the National Security Council in the White House, which is another civilian organization reporting directly to the president. Well, the CIA is a civilian organization, even though it has a special activities division, which is paramilitary in nature. Its paramilitary force operates clandestinely, covertly. And you never hear about it. You'll not hear about the CIA and paramilitary forces that are operating around the world. And that's because the CIA paramilitary forces are targeted against civilians. As soon as you start fighting soldiers in another country, then the military comes in. And their mandate is to fight the military forces in another country. But the CIA fights guerrillas. It fights militias like you'll find in Iraq. It'll fight an organization that's said to be a non-state actor like ISIS. It has a very specific mandate to wage these kind of secret wars that are political in nature and aimed at civilians, not military forces. The other thing that the CIA does, which is, you know, part of this complex interaction with the military, it covertly begins experimental programs like the Phoenix program that the military will take over once that program, which has been developed clandestinely, covertly, is ready to go public. And you don't hear, again, you won't hear about that in the press because it's considered a national security secret that the CIA will be organizing paramilitary forces or militias in a foreign country, hiring civilians from that country to work, not for their own government, but for the United States government, either to act as counterinsurgents or, as in Syria, to act as insurgents trying to overthrow another government. The CIA is absolutely and totally responsible to do those things. If it rises to the point where a war begins, then the military comes in and takes over. So there's actually congressional mandates which absolutely define where the CIA can go. And there are congressional mandates that define where the military can go. And there's attorneys in the State Department making sure that both these organizations play by the rules. So we may not know the detail, but it's all very carefully managed so that nobody is really stepping on anybody's toes. Plus which, a program like Phoenix was instituted to more perfectly coordinate CIA and military operations. And that's the beauty of it for the top managers in the National Security Council or anywhere in the civilian government in the United States. They have now refined these systems and the way to organize and manage them so that the Phoenix model can be perfectly applied anywhere around the world. And the CIA in 2015 actually reorganized itself. You can read about it in the New York Times. Apart from creating a new digital innovations division to handle all its keystroking and hacking of foreign governments and our own and friendly governments, it actually has created 10, 15, 20 of these Phoenix-style centers around the world and is now organizing itself in this manner so it can more perfectly coordinate with military forces and the State Department in countries where it's fighting this war on terror.
How large of a bureaucracy would you say that the CIA is? This sounds like it's gigantic.
Yeah. I think it has a budget that's, you know, it's always hard to find out what the CIA budget is because it hides a lot of its budget in the military or organizations that are covering for it. Even the DEA provides cover for CIA agents. You don't walk around when you're in the CIA with a little badge that says, "Hi, I'm in the CIA." Every CIA officer that's overseas has a cover. CIA, as part of its congressional mandate, can say to the State Department, "We want 100 of your positions this year." If you can say to the military, "We want 1,000 of your positions this year to cover our officers." So a lot of that money that's paying for CIA officers never gets acknowledged in any budget because it's all undercover. And if you were to say, well, the military's covering, you know, $5 billion for the CIA this year, well, then it wouldn't be the CIA anymore. So, but just what's up front is like $35 or $50 billion a year. Of course, the military is $750 billion a year. It's rapidly approaching a trillion. So the military is much bigger and it's a much bigger organization. But in terms of affecting policy and in terms of having a political impact in the foreign countries that the United States would like to occupy militarily or overthrow, the CIA has a much wider intelligence network. There was recently an article that just talked about, even though all the attention goes to the new Joint Special Operations Command and the special forces in the military, that the CIA is really the force behind all these special forces programs. And it's paving the way for them. The Joint Special Operations Command never goes into a country and starts operating there until the CIA has set the scene for them politically and corrupted the politicians in a particular country and made sure that they're going to allow the military to start sending special forces into a country. And the fact of the matter is that many of the highest ranking members of the military's Joint Special Operations Command are actually CIA officers operating under cover because it was the same back in Vietnam. You can't have the military going into a foreign country and wreaking political havoc. Everything has to be coordinated at a very high political level, which means liaison. The CIA has liaison with police officials, with government officials, with civilian officials, civilian businessmen, landowners, all sorts of people in foreign countries that are covert. And that's where the bread and butter is having this political support that allows the military to go in. Unless you understand that, you can't understand the distinction between the military and the CIA. And I can tell you right now, the American press corps is not going to tell you. They're not going to explain all this in the kind of detail that you need to know to understand not only the relationship between the CIA and its organization and operations overseas, but how it also it impacts things that happen here in the United States domestically.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Douglas Valentine. Today's show, Phoenix as the model for homeland security and the war on terror. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. With regard to the Phoenix program in Vietnam specifically, you had extensive talks with this guy, Mr. Brickham, and he divided the operations, according to your book, of Phoenix into three categories. The Hamlet Informant Program, which concerned low-level informants in the villages and hamlets. The Province Interrogation Center Program and captured documents. And Agent Penetrations, that is recruitment in place of Viet Cong. I was thinking maybe you could talk about these three different operations and then ultimately about how some of these terror attacks that were instigated, that the people carrying them out would dress as if they were Viet Cong. They were like false flag operations all over the place, where these people that would stage attacks, violent attacks, on the Vietnamese infrastructure, which is actually the... just the people, they would be led to believe that these terror attacks were being carried out by the Viet Cong, when in fact they were being carried out by the South Vietnamese or the CIA or the U.S. military, right?
Absolutely. Nelson Brickham was a magna cum laude grad of Yale University who went into the CIA in 1949. He was a World War II veteran. Most of the CIA officers that I talked with were World War II veterans. They were older men. Most of them were retired. And because Colby, who, of course, was also a World War II veteran, he had parachuted into France with the OSS and organized resistance to Germany and the Germans, they were older generation, and they looked upon me. My father was a World War II generation guy. He was a veteran, World War II veteran. Because Colby had sent me to them, they looked at me paternalistically, and they liked me, which is one of the reasons the CIA got so mad at me, because guys like Brickham actually thought that I was sent by Colby to get the absolute truth about the Phoenix program. And so they spilled the beans. They told me things that you'll never hear a CIA officer talk about, things that you're not going to read about in a book written by some war correspondent who works for the New York Times or the Washington Post or the LA Times or CBS. You know, they don't get anecdotal. They don't talk about at length. You never read lengthy interviews with anybody from the CIA, but I got that access. And this guy, Brickham, talked for hours and days. I probably spent a week with him. All my interviews with him are on the internet. They're online. Anybody who wants to listen to the interviews can go to them. I recorded them, so it's there. And that's one of the reasons that the CIA hated me so much. They started spying on me. When I was doing this book, they actually, you know, kept a file on me, which I got years later. But Brickham gave me the PhD level lesson in CIA operations. And that's all in the book. He talked not only about the Hamlet Informant Program, the interrogation centers and the value of agent penetrations. He talked about it in detail. He named the CIA officers who were involved in these programs. He told me about the conflicts and the competitions that CIA officers had amongst themselves and how these things affected operations. For example, Brigham was in the foreign intelligence staff. And within the CIA, the foreign intelligence staff works in liaison with secret policemen in foreign countries. Brigham's sort of main competitor was a guy named Donahue who ran the CIA's covert action program. Brigham described that as an intelligence gathering operation that works undercover. The covert action people created the hit teams, the counterterror teams. They created the armed propaganda teams. They created something that was called census grievance, in which the CIA teams would go into a village, apart from the Hamlet informant program, with a little shack, a portable shack, and people could go in and talk to somebody from the South Vietnamese government about their grievances, you know, and supposedly they could do it without the police knowing about it. So there were all these different programs that were ongoing and were conflicting with them, and Brigham tried to bring them all to coordinate all of these even competitive CIA programs through the Phoenix program. All of a sudden now, the covert action people, that staff, would be working with the foreign intelligence staff. Brigham talked primarily about his programs as a foreign intelligence officer, which are the three programs you just mentioned, the Hamlet Informant Program, the Interrogation Center Program, and agent penetrations. Through their liaison with the South Vietnamese police, Brigham and his foreign intelligence staff tried to recruit agents in every informants in every village in South Vietnam. It was a massive program totally funded by the CIA. The South Vietnamese police had no money. All the money came from the CIA. Brigham said it cost about $1 million a year for all his foreign intelligence programs in South Vietnam. Of course, there were these incentives so the police could make some money on the side, which I was talking about earlier. The covert action programs, the guy who ran them, Donahue, whose interviews are also online, told me that was about $25 million budget. So I even knew how much money they were ostensibly claiming. And Brigham said about the Hamlet Informant Program, the whole counterinsurgency depended on informants. I said, without informants, you're dead. With informants, you can do anything. So they poured a lot of money and a lot of intention into getting informants, just the way, I should add, the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI and police departments around the country in the United States today are actively going out and trying to get informants to, you know, through all sorts of different programs that Department of Homeland Security is creating here in the United States. Same thing. Law enforcement can do anything if it has informants. It can't do much if it doesn't. So, you know, it's important to understand that system is applied here as well. The big deal were the interrogation centers and the agent penetrations as well. Brigham introduced me to the CIA officer who ran the interrogation center program in South Vietnam, a guy named John Muldoon, who I spent a couple of days with. I met him at his brother's polo farm. His brother was a fabulously wealthy attorney in Washington who owned polo farm, huge, you know, I mean, with the white fences for miles, you know, and the horses prancing around and all that stuff, and guys with funny hats swinging sticks. Muldoon ran the interrogation center program. I spent 2 days with him, and he outlined to me the whole interrogation center program. The whole idea was to build an interrogation center in each province in South Vietnam, which was run by the special branch of the South Vietnamese police. A CIA foreign intelligence officer in each province was in a liaison relationship. He was an advisor to the top special branch, South Vietnamese special branch officer in the province. And together, they would work on identifying members of the National Liberation Front. Informants would, you know, say, well, Vin, you know, over in that village, he is the party's district leader. And so the CIO would send a hit team from the covert action program to grab this guy, and they bring him to the interrogation center. The CIA started building these interrogation centers in early 1965. The company they hired to actually oversee the construction was an American corporation called Pacific Architects and Engineers. They had a blueprint. The CIA would buy property on the outskirts of the capital in the province, you know, buy 10, 20, 30 acres, clear it off. Pacific Architects and Engineers would hire a local South Vietnamese contractor, and they would go in, they would build an interrogation center. I describe them in the book and at length with this interview with Muldoon. And they would then give, free of charge, this interrogation center to the South Vietnamese police special branch. And they would, the CIA would train the officers, the South Vietnamese police special branch officers who worked in it. They would train them how to interrogate people. There was usually about 75 cells. So I outlined the whole detail of them. They're pretty much the model for all the black sites. These Phoenix interrogation centers, they almost look exactly, if you've ever seen a picture of like the black sites that the CIA has in Poland or Thailand or wherever, they basically use the same model. And the CIA, so they build an interrogation center in every province, and hired the special branch people to run them, paid all their salaries, and they bugged them so that they wiretapped them, and they bugged the phones. The CIA would, you know, wiretap the phones so that anything that the special branch people were saying, they would hear that too. And all the reports that came out of these interrogation centers were sent to CIA headquarters in Saigon. And if they got a clue about somebody who was very important in the National Liberation Front, rather than going after that person, they would begin an agent penetration operation, which is, according to Brigham, the most important thing that the CIA does. So now you get into real espionage intelligence operations when you start talking about agent penetrations. You know, you've got a guy in the interrogation center, and he says, you know, leave me alone, don't kill my family, and I'll tell you who the district party chief is. The member of the National Liberation Front, who's a member of the Communist Party, the Lao Dong Party, I'll give you his name. And at that point, and I describe the process in detail in my new book, The CIA is Organized Crime, how the recruitment process, I didn't have time to do it in the Phoenix Program book, but I do it in this new book. They begin an agent penetration operation, which are very complex. It's the nuts and bolts of what the CIA does in liaison with the special police in a foreign nation. It's the big thing that they do everywhere. And they try to get, as an agent, somebody who's in the in South Vietnam, they tried to get people working for who are actually in the National Liberation Front. And if they could get them in, a guy working for him or a woman working for him, they would leave him in place for 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years if they could. And they would protect these people. And these people would report back to the CIA and the special branch of the South Vietnamese police, the plans and intentions and strategies. So all throughout South Vietnam, at the same time that the Phoenix program was trying to pacify through violence, intense violence and coercion, of the threat of going to these courts where simply being informed upon that you were going to go to prison without, because you had no defense. At the same time, they were pacifying the lower level, the rural population. They were working to preserve the higher levels of the National Liberation Front. they're actually protecting it throughout the whole country. Part of it had to do with the fact that if the CIA and the South Vietnamese Special Branch started bumping off the senior level people of the National Liberation Front, well, they would go start bumping off all the senior level people of the South Vietnamese Special Branch. They all knew each other. They were related to each other.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Douglas Valentine. Today's show, Phoenix as the model for homeland security and the war on terror. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
I had one CIA guy tell me this story. His name was Ed Brady. My interviews with him are available on the internet as well, at a place called Cryptocom. They're all there. And Brady was working for the Phoenix Directorate, and he was working in liaison with a very senior South Vietnamese Special Branch officer. And they were going around, and they were inspecting Phoenix program operations around South Vietnam. They, you know, just like management does, you know, you got to go look at the factory here or the warehouse there, you know, and make sure everybody's doing what they're supposed to do. And Brady was working in Saigon at a very high level for the CIA. And he was working with a very high level special branch guy. And they went to a city called Da Lat, which is in central Vietnam. And they're sitting in a little cafe. And the South Vietnamese guy says to Brady, "That's the province chief's wife." He said, "That's the South Vietnamese wife, and she's going around getting the monthly payoffs here in this restaurant from people, from this diner." And Brady said, "Well, why doesn't she have one of her subordinates doing it?" And he said, "Well, it's not the South Vietnamese province chief. That's the National Liberation Front province chief. But I know her, you know, and I know her husband. I mean, we all know each other." And Brady said, "Well, let's grab her. Let's set up an operation. Let's, you know, so we can ambush and capture her husband." And the South Vietnamese guy looked at him and he said, "Well, you know, Ed, you're going to be gone in 6 months or maybe a year. But I got to live here, man. And if I start laying a trap for his wife and I start using his children as bait, what do you think they're going to do to me?" And so there was at the very highest levels of this intelligence war, there was what was called a modus vivendi. An accommodation had been reached. And the people who suffered, as in any country, were the poor people. And they're the ones that got smeared and creamed and stomped upon. And there was no protection for them. But through these agent penetration operations, there was another, that's where the modus vivendi was carried out. So they're so sophisticated. The things that are going on are so detailed and so vast that you have to understand that this is the way the CIA operates in every country around the world. It's doing the same thing in Great Britain. It's doing the same thing in France. It's doing this in Ukraine. It took the CIA 20 years to get enough agents and enough agent penetrations and to corrupt enough secret policemen in Ukraine so that they could pull off the coup there that they pulled off a couple of years ago. That's something that the CIA does. That's not something that the military does. And the formation of paramilitary forces in Ukraine, that's something that the CIA does. It may have a military guy who's detailed to them, you know, and leaves the military special forces and goes to work for the CIA. He's not actually a CIA employee, you know, with life insurance and retirement fund and all that stuff. He's just detailed. You know, the CIA will have a lot of those military people come in and help them to organize militias and flesh out these operations. And they work very closely with military intelligence doing these sorts of things. But that's what the CIA does. And even in a country what we're at war with or occupying militarily, like Iraq or Afghanistan, the CIA is handling these political and police operations apart from the military. And as Nelson Brigham stressed to me, any insurgency, counterinsurgency, is essentially a police affair, not a military affair, because you have to have informants in the civilian population. You have to have these secret interrogation centers where you can work the civilians over, and a system of court set up where you can send them to prison and coerce them extra legally. And you have to have these modus vivendi through these agent penetration operations that protect the secret policemen, so they don't have to worry about getting bumped off, and they can operate for years. And you corrupt them, and you give them all sorts of money and gadgets, and in some cases Swiss bank accounts, so that they'll let you do all these extra legal things. And these systems have all been perfected in the 75 years that the CIA has been operating, and now they're computerized, and now they're assimilated into the internet and all the digital things that are going on. And the guidelines with the military are refined. It's absolutely misinformation, and in some cases disinformation, by people in the media, left, right, central, it doesn't matter, to think that somehow the military and the CIA are working at odds with each other. They are very closely coordinated. They're indistinguishable from each other. And especially when it comes to the special forces, they're basically the same thing. And in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, the CIA and the Joint Special Operations Command are absolutely compatible and indistinguishable.
In the Province Interrogation Center program, were you told about torture when you were interviewing a lot of these people who had been in the Phoenix program in Vietnam?
Yeah, the guy who told me about it, this guy John Patrick Muldoon, said absolutely, you know, and he blamed it on the South Vietnamese. He said, well, the South Vietnamese use the old French methods, but of course, it's a secret program. I file a Freedom of Information Act request for all the information that the CIA had on this PIC program, the Province Interrogation Center program. They won't release the files on them, but there are files detailing everything that happened in every one of these interrogation center programs. So the knowledge, again, is there. And, of course, the ultimate was the tiger cages at Khon Son Prison, 90 miles off the coast of South Vietnam, which was sort of the mother of all interrogation centers. And it was the place where all the high-ranking captured civilians who were in the National Liberation Front were sent. They were sent to Khon Son Prison. And that's where the infamous tiger cages were, which were really no better than anything that was going on in these interrogation centers. It's just a concrete cell. People were shackled into position, into a sitting position, and left there for a year. Their legs would deteriorate. There were pictures after the ceasefire in 1972 of some of the people that were released, and they're actually sitting on little, like, skateboards because they couldn't use their legs anymore and just pushing themselves around. So the level of torture that was going on in these interrogation centers beyond anything you can imagine, and it's never been reported. And it's one of the deepest, darkest secrets of the CIA's involvement in the Vietnam War. And not only has it never been reported, but it'll never be. Nobody will ever be able to make a case because it amounted to war crimes on a massive scale, beyond what anybody could ever imagine. And like I said, these interrogation centers have become the model for like the black sites that the CIA sets up all around the world. Pacific Architects and Engineers was the construction company that designed them.
And finally, you write in your book on the Phoenix program, Phoenix symbolizes an aspect of the Vietnam War that changed forever the way Americans think about themselves and their government. Central to Phoenix is the fact that it targeted civilians, not soldiers.
Yeah. And guess what? The people that run our society feel the same way about us, the citizens of the United States, that they feel about the citizens of South Vietnam. And they may tell you that you're special because you're in America, but you're not. And as the income inequality divide gets bigger and bigger, and as the Department of Homeland Security spreads its informant nets and its the same programs that the CIA created in South Vietnam, as these, this is the same thing they have in store for us here. It's why it's important to understand the systems, how the systems are used to manipulate political and social movements, the systems behind political repression, which in the United States are highly refined, but we're civilians too. And all these programs that, that were perfected in South Vietnam and perfected over the years are being turned on us. And the historical arc is there, and you can see it happening before your eyes. And it's going in a predetermined direction, and it's not going to get any better.
Douglas Valentine, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thanks for letting me talk for, at length.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Douglas Valentine. Today's show has been Phoenix as the Model for Homeland Security and the War on Terror. Douglas Valentine is the author of several works of historical nonfiction, including The Phoenix Program about the CIA in Vietnam, and The Strength of the Wolf and the Strength of the Pack, which discuss the history of federal drug law enforcement. He also edited a poetry anthology, With Our Eyes Wide Open, Poems of the New American Century. His latest book is The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World, available at claritypress.com. The Phoenix Program is published by the Forbidden Bookshelf. Visit his website at douglasvalentine.com. That's douglasvalentine.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yarrow Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter that includes recent shows and updates. Email us at Faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
Hey! Again, you know what I'm saying? Now the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution of the mind? If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are
Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Why is so much of the news celebrity journalism? And why does anybody give a darn about some vapid celebrity concocted? Always by the corporate-controlled media. We'll hear a couple of interesting approaches here. First, a passage from a new documentary film called Star Suckers. These people say that paying attention to celebrities may be hardwired into people through millennia of evolution. And it's a great way for corporations to lure money from your wallet into theirs. After that, we'll hear journalist and political analyst Chris Hedges say, well, something pretty similar. Here is Star Suckers.
In the previous lesson, you saw how a lucky few can get trapped inside the spotlight. Our third lesson is about your irresistible attraction to them and how we manipulate this for profit. Evolution can sometimes produce hardwired behavior that generations later causes you problems, like moths flying into a light. Long ago, moths that instinctively flew towards the moon were better at navigating, and this urge got handed down. But now technology has changed their surroundings, and this instinct is more of a hindrance. Darwinists believe that humans also developed powerful urges that kept them alive in times gone by.
Our brains are hardwired to make us social. Very few people can really tolerate social isolation for any length of time.
There is a theory that in the past, there were two types of human. Those who naturally wanted to form groups and those who wanted to be alone. The team players were able to share tasks, and so were able to survive when times got tough, unlike the loners. So the survivors passed on the urge to be part of a group that modern man has inherited. Some early humans instinctively copied the successful, while others tried to learn alone. Well, it's not difficult to see why those who copied the leader would stay ahead of the competition. This is your inheritance, making you naturally copy whoever appears to be the leader of your gang. What if there was also an urge to get as close as possible to whoever you're told is the most successful? Now, this would have been good for women who would have got to mate with the top dom. And those men closest to the alpha male would have gotten to share his women as well as any leftover food. And anyone who naturally didn't want to join an entourage wasn't going to do much reproducing. So it is possible that you have evolved with an instinct to form groups. Copy whoever appears to be successful and to congregate around them. But then technology advanced so quickly that it became possible to convince the mind that a moving image is real. As soon as the trick was used to entertain an audience, our industry was born. By entertaining the world, we were able to grow into powerful and influential corporations. Now, our reach is unparalleled, and we deliver media to you and your children in ways that you cannot control. When we surround you with famous faces, your survival instincts kick in, and you feel the urge to get up close and copy them. This has created a new social hierarchy based around your proximity to anyone well-known.
Here, several young adults are interviewing for a job as personal assistant to a celebrity. Each is willing to give up quite a lot in order to gain a position in the celebrity's entourage. If you can't be a celebrity yourself, joining his entourage is the next best thing.
It's a bespoke private celebrity PA agency. Mm-hmm. What attracted you to the advert? Why did you look at the advert and say, that's something I want to do?
Well, it's clearly simple. It says celebrity PA. Mm-hmm. And they were looking for someone in the industry who really understands what that word means.
Celebrity PA.
Flexibility and motivation. Yeah. And they buy an assistant in a way as well, like a pet.
And they can kick the pet.
Well, unfortunately, they shouldn't do that, but...
Pets get kicked.
I've been working as an actor for about a year since leaving uni. I actually brought a CV with me just for general interest, really.
Yeah, all those good.
Slide it across there. I thought, well, it'd be far more interesting to work in the industry.
Let's say you're working for a very high-profile celebrity whose wife is, you know, getting on a bit, and he's having a series of affairs. What if one of the girls was 16?
That's not really a problem.
15?
To be honest, if a 15-year-old girl wants to do that, she's going to do it anyway. Good on her if she gets to do it with a celebrity.
I mean, you're quite young, obviously got a social life. Would you be happy to give all that up?
Yeah.
Not see your friends or family?
Yeah, that'd be fine.
They need 5 grams of coke.
That's fine.
If you drove, would you break the speed limit?
No.
You wouldn't break the speed limit?
I try not to.
You know, the rules, they always to break them, you know. That's what the rules for. You always have to break them. But I'm never driving anyway on the limit.
What if they wanted to pay for sex and they said to you, find me a prostitute?
I would do that. I did that. I had to do that as well. And basically, this is your job. This is...
Even if things are illegal or...
Even. You just have to do it.
You are the gatekeeper to the celebrity's life. They have crazy people after them. Like, wow. Stalkers, psychos, nut-nuts, crack bags, the whole thing. I mean, would that worry you?
No. I know it sounds really weird, but, do you ever get this feeling where you just want a bit of adventure in your life?
Yeah.
A bit like a movie?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, this all sounds fantastic to me.
But you might end up taking a bullet for them, does that worry you?
Surprisingly, no. Stupid thing to say, you know, I wouldn't mind taking a bullet for someone I don't know, but I wouldn't. That's the sort of adventure and adrenaline I need in my life.
Thank you. Yeah, best of luck.
Nice to meet you.
It's great. Nice to meet you. Thank
okay.
you.
Thank you. Cheers.
Again, there's some interesting research on this. They call the phenomenon basking in reflected glory. In this study, students, and there were several hundred of them, read a short biography of Rasputin, you know, the villain of Russian history. For half of them, they customized the test so that Rasputin had the same birthday as you did, without you knowing. So you're like, here, my birthday is July 28th, so I'm reading it, and Rasputin was born July 28th, whenever. The people that had the same birthday as Rasputin were across the board more likely to say Rasputin was a misunderstood man in history. He was notorious, but he was great, and he played an important role, and that shouldn't be forgotten. And this is just because they share a birthday. The power of association with someone who's famous or even infamous is far more potent than we even realize.
No matter how many celebrities we create, it's never going to be possible for everybody to join an entourage. But there are other ways we can exploit your need to be close to the famous, all from the comfort of your own living room.
Television probably played the biggest part here, because with television, there's an illusion of intimacy. And that visual image, now quite realistic, can be right in one's home, giving us the illusion that we actually know these people.
There is no way evolution could have anticipated the internet. And therefore, we are stuck with a kind of brain machinery which was designed to handle face-to-face interactions. It was not designed to handle virtual interactions. It is a brave new world from that point of view, and that does mean it's easily exploited by people who can figure out how to use that medium to their advantage.
A parasocial relationship is one of those awful technical terms which sounds more fancy than it really is. It simply means that you have a relationship with somebody which is not based upon a face-to-face relationship. It's based upon what you know about that person through the press, what you know about that person through watching him or her on television, despite the fact that you never actually meet the celebrity. I say to my students that the only example that I know of where people have this deep emotional attachment to someone they've never met is the attachment that some people have to God. But the parasocial relationship is created by the media, fueled by the media.
And we all do it.
We all do it, yes.
The more celebrities we create, the more we can capitalize on these bonds. And the younger these relationships are formed, the stronger they're going to be.
A whole Virgin has posted of Zac Efron.
Zac Efron.
Now, I think there's some things that celebrities do that play right into this trick of the box. Pretending it's a two-way relationship, I think, enhances this.
Yeah, I feel like there's a connection there. Yeah. And he loves me.
There is this terrifying prospect that I have that it is actually replacing what we used to call real life, that people are developing stronger imaginary relationships with people who are themselves imaginary constructions, people who are not real.
And our purpose in encouraging you to make one-way friendships? It's simple. To make you buy stuff. Your urge to copy the famous influences your spending, whether you like it or not.
You see how easy it is to keep a man happy? Why not give your husband a carton of Philip Morris cigarettes?
Delivers flavor 20 times a pack.
When it's tougher than ever to be a tiger.
Success is down to finding people like this.
Now for the good bit.
If you have a debt problem
and a prudent approach to banking, you could borrow anything.
Which could be up to 3.5 times your salary.
£1 million.
As long as you keep paying the premium.
Is that too much to ask?
It's going to cost a big fortune this life.
Don't treat me like an idiot.
Do you have any special advice for the young people who drive?
Take it easy, drive, and the life you might save might be mine.
Celebrity endorsement works on an emotional level. We process emotions and we process rational thought in different parts of the brain. So the limbic system, which is the very old part of the brain that sort of says lion on savannah, run away, and that's where we process things on an emotional, almost gut feel level. Imagine a horse and a rider. That piece of the brain is like the horse just working away, and that's where we make decisions and do maths and use spreadsheets, and we try to control the more instinctive parts of our brain. So that's like the rider. But sometimes the rider loses control of the horse. And it's been shown in experiments. If you ask people, would you like fruit salad or chocolate cake? People will go, well, I should take the fruit salad because that's the sensible thing to do, so they'll take the fruit salad. But if you give them a really difficult task to do beforehand, so they're mentally exhausted, they'll go for the chocolate cake, because that's their instinct. And that's how it seems to be with a lot of emotional advertising that's not well labelled. We just process it instinctively.
These forms of advertising are most effective when you're not even aware that you're being sold to.
This is Hannah Montana. It's time to wake up. Seriously, it is. You know what else is serious? Back to school shopping. So gather your list of school supplies, and don't forget Walmart has the Hannah Montana gear, the fashion, and the music you love. So be a superstar yourself and get your things together. And have fun, and good luck this year at school.
Children up to the age of 8, 9, 10 don't really understand the persuasive intent of advertisements. There are people in there trying to sell you something.
I've no doubt our society would be much better if there was a total ban on advertising for any child under 12, and really limiting advertising towards teenagers.
It's possible that there is a link between increasing materialism and the mental health problems that an increasing number of our children show.
In the last 10 years, something has shifted. The number of young people now that would say that a good life is about money, it's about fame, it's about appearance, has shot up dramatically. That's what our young people believe, and why wouldn't they? Because that's the value system that they're picking up from the media. The media do not want to hear this message. It is not in their interest for people to be saying that part of the problem with well-being or confidence or whatever might be the media. And that one of the best and easiest ways for people to actually look after their mental health is to cut down on media consumption. They don't like it.
As we set the public agenda, we'll avoid giving exposure to anything that will discourage you wanting more of our product. By attaching a product to a familiar and likable face, we've developed an unstoppable means of making you spend what you don't have on things you don't need. Most people will say that these tricks don't affect them, but that makes the tricks even more potent. How can you fight something if you don't believe it exists? So strong are these bonds that every piece of information about our celebrities is valuable to you. When we insert famous faces into your eyeline, you're guaranteed to stop and look.
The need to gather social information about the people around us we perceive as influential and powerful is something that is embedded deep within us. There are some studies that have been done at Duke University on rhesus monkeys. And they can do one of two things. And they have a little device hooked up to the eyes so people can see which way the monkeys are looking at. And if they look at one screen, they get a squirt of juicy juice, which is, you know, payment or reward. Or they can look at another screen and see a series of pictures. And what Platt found was, is that these monkeys were willing to give up food or pay for two things. One were to look at the hindquarters of females. Okay, I don't need to explain that. And the second were the dominant monkeys in the group. But why would they give up food? Why would they pay, in effect, to look at the pictures of the dominant members of their group? And the answer is that that information is, it's valuable social information. So the more I know about the dominant monkey in my group, when he eats, where he sleeps, who he likes to mate with, and that way increase the chances of my own survival. But that mechanism is still firing. It's like a ghost ship. And we're not getting anything out of it. We're not ingratiating ourselves to them. We're not enhancing our own abilities to survive. But the mechanism still fires, 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 and we're looking at these pictures.
Not long after the death of Michael Jackson, Chris Hedges focused on this mega celebrity as exemplifying all that's wrong with celebrity culture, capitalism, and the American soul. Some parts of this passage I broadcast perhaps a year ago. Other parts I'm now broadcasting for the first time. Here's Chris Hedges.
In celebrity culture, we destroy what we worship. The commercial exploitation of Michael Jackson's death was orchestrated by the corporate forces that rendered Jackson insane. Jackson, robbed of his childhood and surrounded by vultures that preyed on his fears and weaknesses, was so consumed by self-loathing, he carved his African-American face into a Caucasian death mask. He hid his apparent pedophilia behind a Peter Pan illusion of eternal childhood. He could not disentangle his public and his private self. He became a commodity, a product, one to be sold, used, and manipulated. He was infected by the moral nihilism and personal disintegration that is at the core of corporate culture. And his fantasies of eternal youth, delusions of majesty, and desperate, disfiguring quests for physical transformation were an expression of our own yearning. Jackson was a reflection of us in the extreme. His memorial service, a variety show with a coffin, had an average of 31.1 million television viewers. It was the final episode of the long-running Michael Jackson series. The stories that enthrall us most are real-life stories, early fame, wild success, and then a long, bizarre, and macabre emotional train wreck. O.J. Simpson offered a tamer version of the same plot, so does Britney Spears. Jackson, by the end, was heavily in debt and had weathered a $22 million out-of-court settlement to Jordy Chandler, as well as seven counts of child sexual abuse and two counts of administering an intoxicating agent in order to commit a felony. Jackson reflected back to us our physical and psychological disintegration, especially as many struggle with overwhelming debt, loss of status, and deep personal confusion. The lurid drama of Jackson's personal life meshed with the ongoing dramas on television, in movies, and the news. News thrives on these real-life stories, especially those involving celebrities. News reports on television are mini-dramas. They provide a star, a villain, a supporting cast, a good-looking host, and a dramatic and often unexpected ending. In Fahrenheit 451, Ray Bradbury's novel about a future dystopia, people spend most of the day watching giant television screens that show endless scenes of police chases and criminal apprehensions. Life, Bradbury understood, once it was packaged, scripted, given a narrative, and filmed, became the most compelling form of entertainment. And Jackson was a great show. He deserved a great finale. Those who created Jackson's public persona and turned him into a piece of property, first as a child and finally as a corpse, encased in a $15,000 golden casket, are the agents, publicists, marketing departments, promoters, scriptwriters, television and movie producers, advertisers, video technicians, photographers, bodyguards, recording executives, wardrobe consultants, fitness trainers, pollsters, public announcers, and television news personalities who orchestrate the vast stage of celebrity for profit. They are the puppet masters. No one achieves celebrity status. No cultural illusion is swallowed as reality without these armies of cultural enablers and intermediaries. The producers at the Staples Center in Los Angeles made sure the 18,000 attendees and television audience and even the BBC devoted 3 hours to the tribute, watched a funeral that was turned into another maudlin form of uplifting popular entertainment. The memorial service for Jackson was a celebration of celebrity. There was the queasy sight of groups of children, including his own, singing over the coffin. Brooke Shields, fighting back tears, recalled how she and a 33-year-old Jackson, who always maintained that he was a straight male, broke into Elizabeth Taylor's room the night before her wedding because Michael was too excited to wait until morning to see the wedding gown. Shields and Jackson at Taylor's wedding then, quote, pretended to be the mother and father of Elizabeth Taylor. It sounds weird, Shields said, but we made it real. There were photo montages in which a shot of Michael Jackson shaking hands with Nelson Mandela was immediately followed by one of him with Kermit the Frog. Celebrity culture reduces all of the famous to the same level. Fame is its own denominator. And every anecdote told about Jackson seemed to confirm that when you spend your life as a celebrity, you have no idea who you are. And yet, we live in a culture where we measure our lives by these celebrities. We seek to be like them. We emulate their look and behavior. We escape the messiness of real life through the fantasy of their stardom. We too long to attract admiring audiences for our grand, ongoing life movie. We try to see ourselves moving through our life as a camera would see us, mindful of how we hold ourselves, how we dress, what we say. We invent movies that play inside our heads with us as stars. We wonder how an audience would react. Celebrity culture has taught us, almost unconsciously, to generate interior, personal screenplays. We have learned ways of speaking and thinking that grossly disfigure the way we relate to the world and those around us. Neil Gabler, who has written wisely about this, argues that celebrity culture is not a convergence of consumer culture and religion, so much as a hostile takeover of religion by consumer culture. Jackson desperately feared growing old. He believed he could manipulate race and gender. He transformed himself through surgery and perhaps female hormones from a brown-skinned African-American male to a chalk-faced androgynous figure with no clear sexual identity, And while he pushed these boundaries to the extreme, he only did what many do. There were 12 million cosmetic plastic surgery procedures performed last year in the United States. They were performed because in America, most human beings, rich and poor, famous and obscure, have been conditioned to view themselves as marketable commodities. They are objects, like consumer products. They have no intrinsic value. They must look fabulous and live on fabulous sets. They must remain young. They must achieve notoriety and money, or the illusion of it, to be a success. And it does not matter how they get there. The moral nihilism of this court culture licenses a dark voyeurism into other people's humiliation, pain, weakness, and betrayal. Education, building community, honesty, transparency, and sharing are qualities that will see you ridiculed and voted off any reality show. Celebrities that can no longer generate publicity, good or bad, vanish. Life, these shows teach, is a brutal world of unadulterated competition and a constant quest for notoriety and attention. The cult of the self, which Jackson embodied, dominates our culture. This cult has within it the classic traits of psychopaths: superficial charm, grandiosity and self-importance, a need for constant stimulation, a penchant for lying, deception, and manipulation, and the incapacity for remorse or guilt. Jackson, from his phony marriages to the portraits of himself dressed as royalty, to his insatiable hunger for new toys, to his questionable relationship with young boys, had all these qualities. And this is also the ethic promoted by corporations. It is the ethic of unfettered capitalism. It is the misguided belief that personal style and personal advancement, mistaken for individualism, are the same as democratic equality. It is the celebration of image over substance. Once fame and wealth are achieved, they become their own justification, their own morality. How one gets there is irrelevant. And it is this perverted ethic that gave us Wall Street bankers and investment houses that willfully trashed the global economy, stole money from tens of millions of small shareholders who had bought stock in these corporations for retirement or college, and the heads of these corporations, like the winners on a reality television program who lied and manipulated others to succeed, have walked away with hundreds of millions of dollars in bonuses and compensation. The ethic of Wall Street is the ethic of celebrity.
Thanks to James Corbett for bringing Star Suckers to my attention. www.corbettreport.com. Thanks to Ethan Osland of Black Mask Winnipeg for the excellent live recording of Chris Hedges. And thank you for listening to New World Notes. Check out newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegitimai non carborundum and ciao.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
of truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. On today's show, you'll hear the second part of a speech given by Canadian foreign policy analyst Stephen Gowans, discussing his new book, Washington's Long War on Syria. And that'll be followed by some information on Google censorship and an upcoming event. I know that many of the listeners know that what we've been told about 9/11 is a total fabrication. And it's important to keep in mind that the event of 9/11 is what has been used to allow the government to falsely justify its attacks on Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and Syria through its bogus global war on terror. While pretending to resist al-Qaeda and ISIS, it has been well documented that the U.S. and its allies are actually funding, supporting, and arming these proxy armies. And to get us started with today's show, I'm going to share with you first the two-minute segment by General Wesley Clark talking about his visit to the Pentagon right after 9/11. Stephen Gowans references Wesley Clark's statements right at the beginning of this part of his speech. So here's General Wesley Clark.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, "No." He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to al-Qaeda?" He said, no. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They've just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later. And by that time, we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper. And he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today. And he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran."
And now, here's Stephen Gowans.
Let's jump to 2001, the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. The retired U.S. Army General Wesley Clark told a reporter that during a trip to the Pentagon, he learned of plans the Pentagon had developed to attack a number of countries in the Arab and Muslim worlds. One was Iraq, which was soon attacked. Another was Libya, which was eventually attacked. And a third was Syria. In 2002, Syria was added to the Bush administration's Axis of Evil hit list, this regime hit list. Washington claimed that Syria was developing weapons of mass destruction and sponsoring terrorism. This was the same bogus charge it had leveled against Iraq as a pretext to topple the Arab nationalist government in Baghdad and to privatize an Iraqi economy, which Washington denounced as socialist, and was indeed, to a large degree, publicly owned and planned. Iraq had combined its oil wealth with public ownership and planning of the economy to produce what one former U.S. State Department official had called the Golden Age. He wrote, "Schools, universities, hospitals, factories, theaters, museums proliferated. Employment became so universal that a labor shortage developed." The same former U.S. State Department official wrote about Gaddafi in Libya, that by combining Libya's oil wealth with public ownership and planning of the economy, Gaddafi had enabled Libyans to, quote, "live beyond the dreams of their fathers and grandfathers." In 2003, this is not widely known, but it is certainly not concealed on the public record. But in 2003, following the U.S.-British invasion of Iraq, the United States contemplated extending military operations in Iraq to Syria, but decided that its hands were filled with the pacification of Afghanistan and the difficulties it was encountering in the resistance in Iraq, and that it would have to achieve its regime change goals for Syria by other means. The first alternative to direct military intervention was to impose broad-ranging sanctions on Syria to do what sanctions are always intended to do, destroy economies. Destroy economies in order to make life so miserable for ordinary people that they rise up and overthrow their government. In a country as large as the United States, which has such an enormous impact on the global economy, is able to destroy the economies of small countries like Syria. Sanctions are also useful for propaganda purposes, because once you've destroyed a country's economy, you can attribute its economic difficulties to its failure to follow your economic policy prescriptions. To say, if you had adopted free trade, free markets, free enterprise, you would have been a prosperous economy, but you didn't do so. That's why your economy is suffering, of course, without mentioning the devastating impacts of sanctions. The sanctions, as intended, devastated Syria. In October 2011, the New York Times reported that the Syrian economy, quote, was buckling under the pressure of sanctions by the West. By the spring of 2012, sanctions-induced financial hemorrhaging had, quote, forced Syrian officials to stop providing education, healthcare, and other essential services in some parts of Syria. By 2016, according to a leaked internal UN report, U.S. and EU sanctions on Syria were causing huge suffering among ordinary people and preventing the delivery of humanitarian aid. The veteran foreign affairs correspondent Patrick Coburn, who writes for The Independent, likened the sanctions imposed on Syria to sanctions that had been imposed on Iraq from the early 1990s to 2003. Those sanctions, according to a UN estimate, had led to the deaths through malnutrition and disease of at least 500,000 children. More deaths than had been produced by all the weapons of mass destruction in history. As a result, two political scientists, John and Carl Mueller, had called the sanctions of mass destruction, more devastating than the atomic bombs that had been dropped on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, more devastating than all the mustard gas used in the First World War. In effect, the United States had taken measures equivalent to dropping two atomic bombs on Iraq. Largely unrecognized is that sanctions of this caliber have been destroying Syria for the last 14 years. You know, we see attacks carried out by Washington's proxy guerrilla armies. We see the beheadings, we see the eviscerations, we see the barbecuing of heads, we see the suicide bombings. But what we don't see are the invisible, but equally, if not more destructive, effects of sanctions. Significantly, the moment sanctions were lifted on a defeated Arab nationalist Iraq in 2003, they were immediately imposed on an unbowed Arab nationalist Syria. Which means that from the early 1990s to 2017, for the last quarter century, the United States and its allies have waged a highly destructive campaign of economic warfare, the commercial equivalent of a nuclear attack, first on Iraq, subsequently on Syria. And why? Why have they done this? Because they're opposed to the Arab nationalist efforts to bring the economies of the Arab world under the control of people who live and work in the Arab world. Well, sanctions constituted the first means by which regime change was to be brought about. The second was to ignite or reignite the Islamist war on the Syrian state. The Islamist war that had been more or less quelled by 1982. But in 2006, Syria's Muslim Brotherhood had at least two meetings at the White House, according to the Wall Street Journal. In 2007, the Muslim Brotherhood helped found the National Salvation Front. The front met frequently with the U.S. State Department, with the National Security Council, as well as with the U.S. government-funded Middle East Partnership Initiative. In late 2010, just a few months, in fact, December 2010, just a few months before riots were to erupt in the Syrian city of Dara, marking the beginning of what would become known as the Arab Spring in Syria, the Muslim Brotherhood voiced its hope for a civil revolt to oust Assad's so-called heretical government. Well, the hope that a civil revolt would soon erupt was realized only a few short months later, an outcome that the United States and Muslim Brotherhood had been working on since 2006. But in early 2011, before the uprising in Dara, this upheaval swept across the Arab world, all was quiet in Syria. And this perplexed Western news organizations. I mean, there were demonstrations in Tunisia. There were demonstrations in Egypt. There was an uprising in Libya, but not the slightest evidence of distemper in Syria. So the New York Times and Time magazine dispatched reporters to find out what made Syria different. And here's what they reported. They said all was quiet in Syria because the government had broad support. They said all was quiet in Syria because even critics concede that Assad is popular. They said all is quiet in Syria because Assad has, and this is Time magazine, has endeared himself to the population, especially youth, the segment of the population from which rebellion was expected to spring, if indeed rebellion materialized. They said all is quiet in Syria because attempts to organize protests against the government had failed. Syrians, they said, felt no compulsion to protest against their government. And you can confirm all of this yourself. It's quite easy to do. Just go to the Internet archives of the New York Times or Time magazine for the months January, February, March, and April 2011 and read the stories on Syria. Well, in mid-March 2011, riots broke out in Dara. They were violent. Some rioters carried arms. Buildings were burned. Vehicles were set fire to on the street. Even U.S. officials, according to the New York Times, quote, acknowledged that the demonstrations weren't peaceful and that some protesters were armed. In the mythology that would later develop about the origins of the post-2011 or post-2010 conflict, this became the protests were largely peaceful, which I guess is another way of saying they're violent, but a way of putting it so it seems like they're peaceful. Eventually, the modifier largely was dropped altogether so that the story became the demonstrations were peaceful. And you can hear many people tell you today with great certitude that the demonstrations were peaceful without offering the slightest evidence to show how it is that these were peaceful. A week after the outbreak of violence in Dara, Time reported that there do not appear to be widespread calls for the fall of the regime or the removal of the relatively popular president. Well, that clashes with the narrative, the mythology that would be subsequently developed. Over a month after the outbreak of violence and rioting in Dara, the New York Times' Anthony Shadid would report, quote, the protests fall short of popular upheaval of revolutions in Egypt and Tunisia. Significantly, Time magazine would report that Islam was playing a significant role in the protests. So, if you look back over the long war on Syria, what do you have? You have civil disturbances fomented by Islamists dating to the 1960s. You have an Islamist guerrilla warfare, or guerrilla war, dating to the 1970s, culminating in the violent takeover of Hama in 1982. You have Islamists meeting with the White House, with the State Department, with the National Security Council from 2006 after Washington decides or abandons plans for direct military intervention in Syria. And we have Islam, according to Time magazine, playing a prominent role in the protests, which are violent and involve arms. Consistent with this, in 2012, the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency, one of a number of intelligence agencies in the U.S. intelligence community, reveals that the insurgency is Islamist and led by the Muslim Brotherhood and Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the forerunner of ISIS. So you have indication after indication that the uprising was not a peaceful, secular movement for democracy, but a renewal of Syria's decades-long civil war between Islamists and secularists, egged on by the United States and U.S. allies. Indeed, The Defense Intelligence Agency said that the insurgents were supported by the West, that they were supported by the West's allies in the Gulf and by Turkey. There are a number of other reasons to conclude that the uprising had nothing whatever to do with the pursuit of a secular liberal democracy. First, the Swedish Institute of International Affairs had observed that virtually all the members of the various armed insurgents groups are Sunni Arabs. The fighting has largely been restricted to Sunni Arab areas, whereas areas inhabited by Alawis, Druze, and Christians are passive or supportive of the government. Defections from the state are almost 100% Sunni. Money, arms, and volunteers pour in from the Islamic states or from pro-Islamic organizations. And, this is the Institute, religion is the insurgent movement's most important common denominator. So if this rebellion was guided by secular, liberal, democratic goals, why are Alawis, Druze, and Christians not participating? Second, the Assad government amended the country's constitution in response to the uprising to allow multi-candidate presidential elections. It also suspended the security law, which is the Syrian equivalent of our War Measures Act. The security law had been invoked for a number of reasons, not least of which is that Syria remains officially at war with Israel, and Israel illegally occupies Syrian territory on the Golan Heights. These concessions, I mean, in the direction of liberal democracy, were immediately rejected by the insurgents and by their supporters. Instead, the insurgency heated up, despite the fact that Syria now more closely approximated the paradigm of multi-candidate or multi-party representative democracy favored by the West than virtually any other Arab country, and certainly more so than the allies or the Arab allies of the United States, which are all military and royal dictatorships. Third point, this is a tart observation made by Zbigniew Brzezinski, Jimmy Carter's national security advisor. He said, you know, we started helping the rebels, whoever they are, and they're certainly not fighting for democracy given their sponsorship, Qatar and Saudi Arabia. Well, he might have added, they're certainly not fighting for democracy given that their main sponsor is the United States, which promotes not democracy but U.S. business interests. The late Middle East specialist Patrick Seale wrote that the Syrian uprising should be seen as only the latest, if by far the most violent, episode in a long war between Islamists and Ba'athists, which dates back to the founding of the secular Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party in the 1940s. It's not inspired by liberal democratic goals. I mean, it's inspired on the part of the insurgents by Islamic goals, sectarian goals, and on the part of the United States by neo-colonial goals. At the same time, the veteran foreign affairs correspondent Patrick Coburn wrote not too long ago that Washington has always wanted to get rid of Assad, not since 2011 when Obama told Assad that he needed to step down, from 2000 when Assad became president. Just as Washington has always wanted to get rid of his father, who they viewed as an Arab communist. So, you know, the United States and sectarian Sunni political Islam formed an alliance of convenience to eliminate a common enemy from the Syrian state. But, should be emphasized, the enemy is not Assad. It's not Assad alone. I mean, the standard operating procedure of U.S. campaigns of regime change is to reduce governments Washington abhors to a single individual who can be demonized as a Hitler or branded a brutal dictator or an animal, as Trump calls Assad, or a moral disgrace, as Noam Chomsky calls Assad, and so on. But the enemy is not the individual. If Assad were to step down today and leave in his place a successor who also espoused Arab nationalist values, the war would continue. Indeed, when the Ba'ath Arab Socialist Saddam was driven from power in Iraq, the military dictator Washington installed in Iraq initially, Paul L. Bremer, what was his act number one? Act number one was de-Ba'athification of the state. That is, removing from the Iraqi state every secular Arab nationalist. Washington then effectively imposed a constitution on Iraq, which bars forever secular Arab nationalists from holding places in the Iraqi government or Iraqi state. So the objective of Washington's long war in Iraq was the de-Ba'athification of the Iraqi state. The objective of Washington's long war in Syria is the de-Ba'athification of the Syrian state. So let me close on this. So a year after, Muammar Gaddafi, inspired by the Arab nationalist goals of unity, freedom, and socialism, was removed from power by Islamists backed by NATO. The Wall Street Journal revealed, and this always happens, it seems, you know, about a year after some event, you can read in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times what was really going on. The Wall Street Journal revealed that Western companies had, or oil companies had, agitated for Gaddafi's removal because he was driving hard bargains with Western oil companies and insisting that Libyans benefit from their own oil resources. The State Department complained that this was resource nationalism. Well, you know, U.S. oil companies believe that the petroleum resources of the Arab and Muslim world should be used for the enrichment of their shareholders. But there's a systemic reason for that. They're supposed to behave that way. In their view, the shareholders come first. These resources aren't to be used for the benefit of people who live in the region. Gaddafi had the very opposite view, and as a result, he was eliminated. So, a day before this book went to press, I read a short essay by a notable Canadian, Norman Bethune. The essay was titled Wounds. Bethune, for those of you who don't know, not everyone knows who Bethune was a skilled and innovative surgeon who was at the forefront of the struggle for public health care in Canada. But he's perhaps best known for participating in two wars in the late 1930s. The first was the Spanish Civil War. The second was the Second Sino-Japanese War. In the Second Sino-Japanese War, Bethune joined Mao's forces as a frontline surgeon in the resistance against Japanese efforts to colonize China. It was in China that Bethune wrote his essay. And his essay was a meditation on the causes of war in which he was entangled, which produced the wounds that he was called upon every day to operate on. And as I read the essay, it struck me that what Bethune was saying in a very few words was what I had struggled in a whole book to say. So I quickly asked my publisher if he could include a short quote from Wounds as the epigraph of the book, which he readily agreed to. So let me read you the epigraph. Our wars of aggression, wars for the conquest of colonies, just big business. Yes, would seem so, however much the perpetrators of such national crimes seek to hide their purpose under banners of high-sounding abstractions and ideals. Today, the high-sounding abstractions and ideals are expressed in the claim that the West has a moral obligation to act, that we have a responsibility to protect, that we cannot stand idly by, and so on. The most insightful part of Bethune's essay, in my view, is the last paragraph. So he wrote, "What do these enemies of the human race look like?" And he's referring to those who, in the hunt for profit, start the wars which create the wounds that he's called upon to heal. Do they wear on their foreheads a sign so they may be told, so they may be shunned and condemned as criminals? No. On the contrary, they are the respectable ones. They are the pillars of the state. They are the pillars of the church. They are the pillars of society. They support private and public charity out of the excess of their wealth. They endow institutions. In their private lives, they are kind and considerate. But there's one sign by which these gentlemen can be told. Threaten a reduction in their profits, and the beast in them awakens with a snarl. They become ruthless as savages, brutal as madmen, ruthless as executioners. And when you read in the Wall Street Journal that Western oil companies had complained to the U.S. State Department that something had to be done about the Arab nationalist Gaddafi, who threatened a reduction in their oil profits, it's hard not to think of the pillars of society and respectable people of whom Bethune wrote. Well, Bethune ended his essay with this: "Such an organization of human society as permits them to exist must be abolished." And the overarching theme of this book is this: Washington's long war in Syria can only be understood within the context of the organization of human society as permits these enemies of humanity to exist. Thank you.
And again, you were just listening to the final part of a recent speech given by author Stephen Gowans. His latest book is called Washington's Long War on Syria, published by Baraka Books. Stephen Gowans has a website called What's Left, and you can get to it by going to www.gowans.wordpress.com. So gowans.wordpress.com, and Gowans is spelled G-O-W-A-N-S. So gowans.wordpress.com. And now, let's take a brief look at Google censorship. Here's a short clip from RT that exposes it.
Google announced changes to its algorithm search last April, aiming to combat so-called fake news and conspiracy theories. In a blog post, a company executive said the technology would change its search rankings to help surface more authoritative pages and demote low-quality content. But according to my next guest, some believe this new algorithm is doing more than filtering out fake news. Andre Demin, reporter for the World Socialist website, thank you so much for joining us today. So before the election, many on the right were complaining that conservative articles were not coming up on Google searches, and now we're hearing something similar from the other side of the aisle. So you believe that the website you work for in particular is being targeted?
Yes, and among a whole series of left-wing, progressive, and anti-war websites. We have found, using our research based on the Amazon Alexa search tool and ratings tool, that the rankings and traffic of many left-wing websites have plummeted after Google implemented a new search algorithm, which was announced in that blog post you referenced on April 25th. And that had a tremendous impact on the amount of traffic, according to a number of websites that we've spoken to, coming from Google to progressive websites and left-wing websites. And yes, the World Socialist website was certainly affected.
And in terms of the right or left, regardless of political affiliation, should Google be in the business of determining what's fake news? And is this an infringement of freedom of speech, or is this a way to really help to stop spreading misinformation all over the place?
Well, we think that Google has no business in deciding what political viewpoints can and cannot be presented to users. If a user searches any topic on a political question, he or she should have a wide range of viewpoints that are presented to them. But the vision that was outlined in the April 25th document explaining the changes to Google's algorithm is something completely different. It envisions Google becoming a censorship engine rather than a search engine, in which it has a whole series of internal guidelines with evaluators, which are a little more effectively than censors, who decide what is real and what is fake, what news should be presented and what news should not be presented. And the effect is that people's opinions, if they don't line up with the interests of Google, which is one of the most politically connected corporations on the planet, having given more in lobbying donations over the recent period than any other corporation, if they don't line up with the interests of Google, if they don't line up with the interests of the government, if they don't line up with the interests of the military and intelligence establishment, they will be censored. And the vision outlined in that document is entirely consistent with the statistics that we've seen.
So there's pretty serious censorship going on as the corporate media giants lose control of the message they're told to deliver. I hope you'll use other search engines, and we can only hope they're not involved in the censorship, too. And now for the event. It will be on Saturday, August 12th at the Juicy J Juice Bar in Hartford. It's at 494A Farmington Avenue. The Connecticut 9/11 Truth Group will be showing the first part of the film Incontrovertible at the Juicy J's Juice Bar at 7 p.m. And again, that's Saturday, August 12th. So come and join us for some healthy food and drink from the Juicy J Juice Bar and see this incredible film that presents the evidence that explodes the official story of 9/11. And again, that's Saturday, August 12th at the Juicy J Juice Bar, 494A Farmington Avenue in Hartford at 7 p.m. And that concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening. Power to the people, right on.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges. Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Eric LeCompte, Executive Director of the Jubilee USA Network, who explains why his group and others are advocating debt relief for both Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands after the destruction of recent hurricanes. Tyson Slocum, Director of Public Citizens Energy Program, who explores the potential of post-hurricane shattered Puerto Rico to become a model for conversion to renewable energy. And Frederick Clarkson of Political Research Associates, who assesses the significance of Christian right extremist Roy Moore's Republican Senate primary victory in Alabama. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
More than 90% of Kurds living in northern Iraq voted in favor of establishing an independent Kurdistan in a September 25th non-binding referendum. Iraq, Iran, Turkey, and the United States opposed the move toward creating the first Kurdish state. The current semi-autonomous Kurdish region is rich with oil reserves and is a key ally in the military campaign against the jihadist Islamic State, or ISIS. Days after the plebiscite, Iraq, in a first set of promised economic sanctions, halted international flights to Erbil, the capital of the Kurdish region. Turkey has threatened to shut down the oil pipeline, which pumps over 600,000 gallons of Kurdish oil to Turkey daily. Iraq also pledged to retake oil fields in the city of Kirkuk, which has been under control of the Kurdish army since 2014, when the Iraqi army fled in the face of an ISIS offensive in the region. Today, over 30 million Kurds live across the Middle East, concentrated mostly in Iraq, Turkey, Syria, and Iran. After World War I, the Kurds were ruled by the British and later Iraq. Over the last century, the Kurds have waged a number of rebellions to win their independence. In 1991, they won a semi-autonomous state inside Iraq during the First Persian Gulf War and remain under the protection of Western powers. After a weekend of tweeting insults against African-American pro football players, President Donald Trump came face-to-face with the growing humanitarian crisis in Puerto Rico. The Commonwealth of 3.5 million people took a direct hit by Category 4, Hurricane Maria, and after 2 weeks, most of the island is without power, running water, or cell phone service. As a sign of the mounting crisis, hundreds of cargo containers filled with emergency supplies, including food and water, were stranded in a San Juan port. The crisis is provoking a new exodus of Puerto Ricans to leave the island for the U.S. mainland. Meanwhile, President Trump launched a Twitter war against the people of Puerto Rico, who have been critical of the federal government response, including the mayor of San Juan, Carmen Yulín Cruz, who had made an emotional televised plea for help for her city. Prior to Hurricanes Maria and Irma, Puerto Rico's infrastructure was the victim of a decade-long debt crisis and deep recession. The island's government is now seeking to restructure over $120 billion in debt in U.S. courts. While electric power was restored after Hurricane Irma, Maria left the electric grid effectively destroyed with little prospect for power or cell service to return anytime soon. American energy experts, now in Puerto Rico, say restoring the island's power will involve much more than replacing downed poles and cables. The entire system of generation, transmission, and distribution must be rebuilt, including replacement of high-voltage transmission lines. The election of Donald Trump and his appointed right-wing Justice Department, led by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, has pushed the Black Lives Matter movement to rethink its political strategy. The movement first emerged after the acquittal of George Zimmerman in the murder of Florida teenager Trayvon Martin. Black Lives Matter has largely been defined by its protests and the aftermath of police shootings of young black men and demands to reform the criminal justice system. But now, Sessions and Trump are moving to remilitarize local police departments. With their eyes on midterm elections in 2018, Black Lives Matter organizers are focusing on mobilizing the black vote and challenging voter repression laws. The Lansing, Michigan chapter of Black Lives Matter is promoting a statewide Get Out the Vote campaign called Election 20XX. As the midterm elections draw near, organizers are laying the groundwork for two new initiatives, the Electoral Justice Project and the Black Futures Lab,
that they say will address the way in which some Democratic candidates alienate the black community. Identifying exciting candidates and deploying national resources to campaigns where they're needed is just one part of the Black Lives Matter electoral game plan. In November, the Movement for Black Lives Electoral Justice Project, an effort to educate and mobilize black voters, will kick off with town hall gatherings in cities throughout the South and Midwest. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The destructive power of Hurricane Maria, which smashed tens of thousands of homes, knocked out electric power and phone service for most of Puerto Rico's 3.5 million residents, was the worst storm to hit the island in nearly a century. When the federal government's response was late to initiate rescue operations and provide emergency food, water, and fuel, criticism bubbled to the surface. But very few observers, however, would have predicted that in the midst of such a serious humanitarian crisis, President Trump would have launched a Twitter war against the people of Puerto Rico, essentially labeling residents as lazy. Among the public officials Trump attacked were San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulín Cruz, accusing her of playing politics and being a poor leader. When the president arrived for a visit to Puerto Rico 2 weeks after the storm on October 3rd, he congratulated himself and his administration for its response to the disaster. In a bizarre moment, Trump then said the island should be very proud of its low official death count of 16, comparing the situation to Hurricane Katrina in 2005, based on the number of people who had died, implying that Puerto Rico's current crisis wasn't a real catastrophe. But the disastrous situation in Puerto Rico predates the ravages of Hurricane Maria. 60% of the island's children live in poverty, and its people have been dealing with a decades-long economic crisis that amassed a $72 billion debt, triggering the largest bankruptcy process in U.S. history. Your reporter spoke with Eric LeCompte, executive director of the Jubilee USA Network, who discusses island religious leaders and his group's advocacy of debt relief for both Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands after the devastation wrought by Hurricanes Irma and Maria.
In particular, we definitely want the bankruptcy process in Puerto Rico to continue to move forward. And that process is going to take into account the devastation of the hurricane and ensure a higher haircut in terms of the debt. In terms of the aid that comes from the United States, that comes from the federal government, we want it to be robust in the form of grants that goes in terms of relief aid to Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. We don't want Puerto Rico or the U.S. Virgin Islands to have to get more debt in order to finance its reconstruction and recovery. It's also absolutely imperative that the aid that comes in is sufficient to rebuild Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands in ways that are going to be able to withstand what seem to be more powerful and more frequent storms in this moment of our history. And the final piece that we and our partners in Puerto Rico are advocating, and it actually impacts many of the Caribbean islands that have been devastated by the storms, from Puerto Rico to the U.S. Virgin Islands to the countries of Antigua and Barbuda and Dominica, is that we really believe it's incumbent on Congress to pass greater laws around budget transparency, responsible lending and borrowing, because these types of laws prevent financial crisis. These types of laws actually secure protections in the markets, not only for the U.S. citizens living in Puerto Rico and U.S. Virgin Islands, but also in U.S. states and foreign countries, because much of the world's debt is actually contracted through New York law.
Eric, what is the prospect that we'll have a Republican-controlled Congress and Donald Trump as president be predisposed to sign into law some of these
debt relief measures, given the hostility we've seen, particularly from the White House?
Well, in terms of Puerto Rico, the bankruptcy process that, in effect, was passed last year with strong support from Republican leadership and Democratic leadership, and then signed into law by President Obama. And not only did that legislation delay debt payments for Puerto Rico in particular, that legislation is also what created this super bankruptcy process, the only bankruptcy process in U.S. history that has the ability to restructure all of Puerto Rico's debt. So in terms of Puerto Rico, they have access to this debt relief process right now, which is very positive. Unfortunately, we are dealing with a different situation with the U.S. Virgin Islands, where it's much more difficult for them to access this legislation. And in whatever relief package comes together for the U.S. Virgin Islands, in some way Congress needs to deal with the debt. At this point, we don't know what that could possibly look like, but we're trying to engage Congress to include that in the package for the U.S. Virgin Islands because they absolutely don't have the resources to pay debt at this point.
Eric, what would you recommend people who are very much alarmed and their hearts going out to the people of Puerto Rico struggling with this disaster? What's an effective way they can help in the short term and the long term?
Well, in the short term, I think it's absolutely critical that we do let Congress know that being able to resolve the situation in Puerto Rico also means that we have to resolve the financial crisis. And the listeners can go to our website, www.jubileeusa.org. Again, that's jubileeusa.org. And we have a petition that's up, which actually is going to the International Monetary Fund in order to secure debt relief and protections for Caribbean countries devastated by Irma and Maria, like Antigua and Barbuda, and the island of Dominica, a developing country totally devastated by Hurricane Maria. And that petition also goes to the White House, to Congress, and to those involved in the bankruptcy process and in governance on the island of Puerto Rico, calling for debt relief as well as to ensure that the island gets the proper amount of aid and grants.
That was Eric LeCompte, Executive Director of the Jubilee USA Network. Find more information and commentary on Puerto Rico's debt crisis and calls for debt relief by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On September 20th, Hurricane Maria flattened Puerto Rico and its electrical grid, plunging the entire island of 3.5 million people into darkness amid a late-season heat wave. 2 weeks later, just a tiny fraction of the power had been restored, and officials are predicting it will take 6 months to get the electrical grid back online. But the system that existed before the storm was almost entirely powered by dirty fossil fuels, like coal and oil. Despite the fact that the sun shines on the island almost every day, cheap, clean solar power was not being harnessed. The cruel irony is that the burning of fossil fuels intensifies climate change, which generates stronger storms with more rainfall, just like Maria. By some estimates, the island of Puerto Rico has the potential to become a learning lab for a conversion to renewable energy, rather than importing coal and oil, which provides precious few jobs. Local people could be hired to build out a sustainable energy grid using solar, wind, and other renewables. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Tyson Slocum, Director of Public Citizens Energy Program, who says the first order of business is to get the electrical grid up and running again. He then discusses some of the opportunities and obstacles that could stand in the way of such a wholesale conversion to renewable energy.
Puerto Rico has what's known as a municipally owned or a publicly owned power system. So as a result, the political entities in Puerto Rico have enormous leverage over the future direction of their electrical system because government institutions have total control over the operations of the utility. The problem in Puerto Rico is staggering debt. You've had a lot of younger, able-bodied people flee the island. The island finances in general are in not very good shape, and the utility itself was forced to declare bankruptcy. So to make new investments, and especially to contemplate significant new investments in different types of infrastructure, different types of renewable energy, is going to take money that right now Puerto Rico and its utility do not have. I think that one of the things that the United States ought to do to show a commitment to growth in Puerto Rico is to focus on investments that are going to help grow the Puerto Rico economy. And one way you can do that is by focusing on renewable energy. There's going to have to be outside capital, whether that's in the form of the U.S. federal government or private sector actors coming in.
What indications do you see that it's really feasible to convert Puerto Rico's energy grid to renewables?
What we're seeing in U.S. electricity markets is a new era of renewable energy dominance. We are seeing massive growth in the deployment of renewable energy, particularly what's known as utility-scale renewables in wind and solar. These are large-scale renewable installations. The economics of these types of deployments of renewable energy, they are outcompeting incumbent fossil fuel and nuclear power plants. This is just a remarkable technological period that we're in right now where renewables are ascending, and they are ascending rapidly. And so the question is, as we are contemplating changes to our electric grid, and particularly in the wake of a devastating natural disaster like what has afflicted Puerto Rico, there's an opportunity here to lay that groundwork. But the government always needs to play a role, and especially in the case here of Puerto Rico, given the special circumstances we have, the government has to play a leadership role in laying that infrastructure groundwork. And the question is the Trump administration just going to focus on a replacement and overlay of fossil fuel infrastructure, or is there an opportunity here for innovation and sustainability? And I think that it is important to have that conversation and to immediately start a feasibility study to assess what kind of renewable energy deployments we can get on to Puerto Rico in the medium term that are going to replace ineffective or damaged fossil fuel infrastructure. And, you know, rooftop solar has been an option, but the economical choice that is better than rooftop solar is utility scale solar. And that's where you've got, you know, large arrays in some sort of concentrated area. It can be on the top of a very large housing development or commercial development. The larger the system, the economies of scale drive those prices down. And so there is a huge opportunity here to start to consider what's known as distributed energy systems, that instead of having a handful of very large central power plants that historically have been powered either by fossil fuel, coal or natural gas, or by nuclear energy. Instead, you disperse dozens or hundreds of smaller scale units closer to neighborhoods and communities that are renewable, that are solar, that are wind. Studies have shown time and time again that these decentralized systems actually have greater resilience in the face of most types of reliability events or other types of natural disaster events. Because if you've got a centralized model, which is a handful of large power plants all connected by large transmission lines, you knock out some of that and huge geographic areas go down. Whereas if a storm affects one part of the island but not others, it's not going to knock out all of these decentralized grids. And so you're able to have greater resilience.
That was Tyson Slocum, Director of Public Citizens Energy Program. Learn more about the viability of renewable energy systems on Puerto Rico by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. When Donald Trump campaigned on behalf of appointed Alabama Senator Luther Strange in the state's Republican Senate primary, he knew that his guy would likely lose. His former chief strategist, Stephen Bannon, along with his far-right website, Breitbart, and former GOP vice presidential candidate, Sarah Palin, all supported Strange's opponent, Christian extremist Roy Moore, who won the election with nearly 55% of the vote. Moore is now the Republican nominee and frontrunner to win the Senate seat, vacated by Trump's Attorney General Jeff Sessions, in a December special election, where he'll face Democratic candidate Doug Jones. Roy Moore was twice elected Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, and twice removed from office for his refusal to remove a Ten Commandments monument from the state judicial building, and for defying a Supreme Court ruling invalidating Alabama's ban on same-sex marriage. Moore is well known for his belief that biblical law supersedes U.S. law and views that homosexuality should be a capital crime, Muslims should not be allowed to hold elected office, and promotion of the conspiracy theory that President Barack Obama was a Muslim not born in the U.S. Your reporter spoke with Frederick Clarkson, senior fellow with Political Research Associates, who discusses the significance of theocrat Roy Moore's GOP Senate primary victory in Alabama, the strength of the Christian right in today's Republican Party, and the threat posed to secular Democratic values.
I mean, Roy Moore certainly sees the Constitution, the First Amendment, as a vehicle for Christianity. He doesn't view it appropriate for Muslims to hold office. He specifically denounced the seating of Keith Ellison, the first Muslim member of Congress, and most interestingly, he calls Islam a false religion. But yeah, he believes that homosexuality and abortion should be criminalized. But and he also doesn't think that the U.S. Supreme Court has the authority to do the things that they've done with regard to abortion rights and marriage equality.
Fred, I would ask you what the significance of his victory in the Alabama Republican primary for this open Senate seat means. What is the importance for our listeners to know about this win that he had the other day?
Well, there are a number of things. I mean, one is that he's demonstrated that the viability and the strength of the Christian right, both in terms of their ideological coherence and their organizational strength, and in Roy Moore's case, the peculiar alliance that is clearly forming between what we've always understood to be the Christian right and what we now know as the alt-right. It's a disturbing coalition that clearly was catalyzed by Donald Trump, but it shows that the political strength is there and that it's populist in the sense that Luther Strange, who was the incumbent Republican, was an established conservative, pro-business, supported by the Chamber of Commerce kind of politician. Exactly the kind of politician that Donald Trump had pledged to throw out. The people who elected Donald Trump still want to do that. And even though Roy Moore may seem wacky to some, he's an anti-establishment guy, and that's good enough for them.
Fred, what does the Republican establishment, quote-unquote, think about Roy Moore? You hear a lot of commentary after this primary victory by Roy Moore that people like Majority Leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, were unhappy because they thought it would make it more difficult for mainstream candidates to win the general election in other states if Roy Moore, like candidates, challenged incumbents in other places around the country.
Well, I think he's absolutely right about that. I think the good news for the Republican Party is that there really aren't any other Roy Moore-like candidates. There may be some Tea Party kinds of figures who are in the House who could make a plausible run at sitting senators like, say, Jeff Flake in Arizona. But, you know, Roy Moore is a one-of-a-kind character, and he's won statewide office twice. And it's very hard to find anybody remotely like Roy Moore who has done that. He's been one of the best-known and controversial politicians in the state for a couple of decades now. And it may be that characters like that arise, but we haven't seen them yet.
But I would ask you, as you look at Roy Moore and the extremist wing of Christian political activists that he represents, what kind of threat do you believe it presents to our democratic values here in the United States today in 2017?
Well, you know, if you were going to hold a popular referendum on these things, they would lose. But it's often the case that it's the best organized faction, the best organized minority that prevails in politics. And if you look at Donald Trump and a lot of these characters, like Roy Moore, they came to Washington not to preserve it and to build it, but to destroy it. The way that we think about democracy and public life and the role of government, you know, the broadest swath of us, really. I mean, people like Donald Trump and Roy Moore and Steve Bannon are more like each other than any of them are like mainstream Republicans and anybody to their left. This is a revolutionary faction who is trying to figure out how to destabilize what we think of as democracy, and particularly the role of the federal government in preserving and advancing democratic values. That's pretty much their stated mission. And Roy Moore, if he becomes a U.S. senator, will be in an unusual position to do it. So he can go in and filibuster and put holds on judicial and ambassadorial nominations as much as he wants to, and he can be a real wrecking ball.
That was Frederick Clarkson, senior fellow with Political Research Associates, co-founder of the blog Talk to Action, and author of the book Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy. Find more commentary on Roy Moore's extremist religious views by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WERU in East Orland, Maine, KDNK in Carbondale, Colorado, KRBX in Boise, Idaho, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, This Way Out.
All of us who identify as LGBTQ lead multi-layered lives. I was reminded of this when I read John Garabedian's book, aptly titled The Harmony of Parts.
I think another important thing to remember in this highly volatile space, very emotional, is to not turn on the tribe. Because there are people who will do and say things that maybe you disagree with, but this is a time when we really do need to stand together.
To This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Tunisia abandons forced anal exams to test for homosexuality. It's the U.S. EEOC versus Trump's Justice Department in a federal workplace gay bias lawsuit. And the ugliness of Australia's marriage plebiscite challenges queer mental health. All that and more this week, now that you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending September 30th, 2017. Tunisia's human rights minister, Mehdi Ben Garbia, told the Agence France-Presse news agency this week that men charged with having sex with men will no longer be forced to undergo anal exams to test for supposed evidence of homosexual activity. A United Nations report in January condemned the practice as medically worthless and said the invasive, humiliating exams amount to torture. The report echoed earlier statements by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and several other global rights watchdogs. The National Council of the Medical Order in Tunisia had also criticized the barbaric practice. Ben Garbia said anal exams requested by a court can no longer be imposed by force, physical or moral, or without the consent of the other person concerned. But he refused to provide the specific date that the new policy will take effect. Sodomy is still punishable in the North African country by up to 3 years in prison. Kenya, Egypt, and Lebanon are among a handful of other nations that continue to employ anal exams to test for supposed homosexuality. The Kenyan Medical Association released a statement this week condemning any form of forced examinations of clients. Kenya's government, however, has yet to comment.
A British lesbian, identified only as QT, and her Hong Kong partner, identified only as SS, won a landmark victory this week in a unanimous Hong Kong Court of Appeals ruling granting QT a spousal visa so she can live with SS and work in the city. The couple entered into a civil partnership in the UK in 2011. But the Hong Kong Immigration Department repeatedly denied visa requests by QT, stating that only foreign spouses of heterosexual couples are eligible for them. In overturning a lower court decision, the three-judge Court of Appeals panel said immigration authorities had failed to justify the indirect discrimination on account of sexual orientation that QT suffers. "Times have changed," Chief Judge Andrew Chung wrote, "and an increasing number of people are no longer prepared to accept the status quo without critical thought. Discrimination against LGBTQ people is against the law in the former British colony, but the court also acknowledged that marriage is not open there to same-gender couples. However, the judges declared the granting of dependent spousal visas involving same-gender couples to be no more than a privilege that has nothing to do with marital status as defined by Hong Kong law." Ray Chan, the city's first openly gay lawmaker, called the ruling a big win for same-sex dependents to apply for visas to stay in Hong Kong.
Bermuda's Royal Gazette newspaper reported this week that the country's health minister, Kim Wilson, is representing a group challenging a landmark court ruling that opened civil marriage to same-gender couples. A Ministry of Health spokeswoman said Wilson is involved in the case as a private attorney and not as a representative of the government. Bermuda gay couple Winston Godwin and Greg DeRoche won the right to marry in May of this year when the judge ruled that denying marriage to them violated their human rights. Several gay and lesbian couples have married on the island since then. The government declined to appeal the decision, but the group Wilson represents, Preserve Marriage, and a separate group with the same goal, point to last year's public vote that rejected marriage equality. One of the filings specifically claims that the ruling was offensive to the culture and custom of the significant portion of the community. It's not yet clear if either group has been granted permission to appeal the ruling, but this week, the same court that ruled for Godwin and DeRoche ordered the government to pay all of the couple's legal costs.
The Philippines House of Representatives has unanimously approved a measure banning discrimination against sexual and gender minorities. It punishes anti-LGBTQ bias with hefty fines and up to 6 years in prison. A companion bill is pending in the Senate. The country's first transgender congresswoman, Geraldine Roman, was one of the sponsors of the measure in the House. She told CNN that she has a master plan for achieving full equality in her country. "First, we start with the anti-discrimination bill," she said. "Then we proceed to civil partnerships, whether same-sex or otherwise. Then we go to gender recognition. Then we can go to LGBT in the military." House Speaker Pantaleon Alvarez has already voiced his support for civil unions that recognize both heterosexual and same-gender partnerships.
Two agencies of the U.S. government are at odds over whether or not current federal law protects gay and lesbian workers from discrimination. The Department of Justice is squaring off with the country's Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. The Justice Department claimed during oral arguments this week at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit that federal law does not protect gays and lesbians from employment bias. The EEOC argues, as it has in other cases during the past several years, that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which bans sex discrimination, implicitly outlaws discrimination based on sexual orientation. A three-judge panel of the Second Circuit rejected the case of a fired gay skydiver in April, but the full court agreed to reconsider that decision after the Seventh Circuit became the first federal appeals court to rule that Title VII does, indeed, protect lesbians and gay men in the workplace. In Zarda versus Altitude Express, skydiving instructor Donald Zarda charged that he was fired for telling a customer that he was gay. Zarda died in 2014, but his sister and partner are continuing to pursue the case. The Justice Department intervened on behalf of the employer, and the EEOC backs the plaintiff. One judge called the situation awkward. Less than half of the 50 U.S. states have laws banning workplace bias based on sexual orientation, and contrary to public perception, there is no federal law that specifically protects those workers. A few states extend the same protections to transgender people. Most observers expect the Supreme Court to ultimately rule on the issue. The queer advocacy group Lambda Legal has already asked the High Court to review an 11th Circuit Court of Appeals case that rejected a lawsuit by a Georgia lesbian who claimed she was fired for her sexual orientation and gender nonconformity.
In other news, the successful revival of the hugely popular U.S. TV sitcom Will and Grace may never be seen in Indonesia. The government has decided to ban all LGBT characters on the small screen. According to the Jakarta Post, the proposed ban on LGBT behaviors on television has been added to a broadcasting bill that's currently being debated in Parliament. Critics argue that news reporting on LGBT rights could be problematic if the measure passes, and that documentaries about sexual and gender minorities could be outlawed. They charge government leaders, many of whom who have spoken out against the rights of sexual and gender minorities in the past several months, with trying to squelch the burgeoning movement for queer rights in the Muslim-majority country. The proposal would require all TV programming and commercials to be reviewed by a censorship board prior to broadcast. One lawmaker claimed that, "We can't allow LGBT behavior on TV. We have to ban it early before it becomes a lifestyle. It's dangerous and can ruin the morality of the younger generation." It's not illegal to be LGBT in Indonesia. Nevertheless, there's strong societal animus towards sexual and gender minorities, and men accused of having sex with men have been publicly caned in the province of Aceh, which is governed by Islamic law.
But finally, about 50 people from Russia, Belarus, and Kazakhstan marched in the first ever LGBT pride parade in the Norwegian border town of Sheshkenes on September 23rd. Public support for LGBT rights is against the law in Russia and many of its former Soviet satellite countries. The Barents Observer reported that the town's mayor led about 200 rainbow flag-waving people in the celebratory procession through a residential area to the city's central square, chanting, "Love is love," in English and Russian, and passing within a block of the Russian consulate. The mayor quoted Norway's King Harald during his brief remarks at the town square, who in a speech in support of diversity and tolerance earlier this year, called for all Norwegians to take care of each other, saying, "Norwegians are girls who love girls, boys who love boys, and boys and girls who love each other." The parade followed a weekend of panel discussions about the dire situation for LGBT people in Russia, especially in the predominantly Muslim region of Chechnya. One of the organizers said they were hoping for a combined Norwegian-Russian pride parade, but that they were really satisfied, even though the event took place on only one side of the border. "Maybe next year," she said.
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 30th, 2017, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Jessica Andrea.
And I'm John Dyer V.
Many people are finding this very, very challenging. Many LGBT people have never experienced this level of vilification.
Surviving Australia's postal plebiscite, later in the program.
The All Cool All Request Open House Party is on the air.
Oh my God, it's my last night hosting Open House Party. And from all the texts and messages I'm getting, tonight we have more listeners than Trump's inauguration.
Our queer life and literature commentator, Janet Mason, discovers the multiple talents of bisexual top 40 DJ writer John Garabedian through his well-titled memoir, The Harmony of Parts.
I was having a spirited, if heated, debate with an older colleague of mine on the bus in New York City. She was insisting that by looking at life through a queer lens, that I was limiting myself. My voice got louder as I explained that when I listened to her advice, I felt erased. Another woman on the bus, who apparently had been listening intently, interrupted us to tell us we were almost at our stop. I said to myself that I understand that not everyone gets everything, so I decided that nothing gay was going to pass my lips for the next several hours. We went to our meeting in Harlem, and then on the way back, as the bus detoured around the Puerto Rican Day Parade, my colleague got into a conversation with a woman sitting in the seat in front of us. The conversation led from the detour to the list of parades that the woman, a lifelong New Yorker, talked about. She was blasé and ended by mentioning the, quote, gay parade. I simply smiled, but my colleague muttered, "Isn't anyone normal anymore?" The woman she was talking to, who was probably in her 60s, somewhere between her two ages, looked at her calmly and said, "Anyone can start a parade. All you need is a permit. You can start your own parade." At this point, I still remained silent, but my suppressed laughter nearly propelled me into the aisle. My colleague and I have since gone our separate ways. But the fact is that she initially had a point, even if my ire got the best of me. All of us who identify as LGBTQ lead multi-layered lives. I was reminded of this when I read John Garabedian's book, aptly titled The Harmony of Parts. Written with Ian Aldrich, the book was published in 2016 by Orange Fraser Press. I learned a few things from reading the book. One was about the radio industry. John was a top 40 radio jock en route to his dream of owning his own station. John is Armenian-American, the son of an Armenian immigrant mother who taught him to pursue his dreams. John is also bisexual, and both of these identities made him feel different growing up. Also, he writes about growing up in an earlier era when masculinity was different. Back then, fathers weren't expected to be affectionate. There is a certain manhood they had to live up to. Get a good job, provide for your family, keep to yourself. Men didn't hug or show affection back then. It was regarded as queer. The book illustrates that radio is an extremely volatile industry. John started his radio career in the late 1950s and early 1960s, around the same time he fell in love with another man. Many of John's positions ended abruptly. At least in one instance, John was fired from a radio show because people, specifically advertisers, found out that he was in a same-sex relationship. This is a book about many things, about pursuing your dreams and how family can be a strong part of the drive that is necessary, as well as offering love and support. It is also a book about the radio industry and musicians he interviewed and how their music can change the world. I'm a big fan of the gay icon Lady Gaga, and in full disclosure, was pulled in by her back cover blurb that says, "If it weren't for John Garabedian, no one in America would know who I am." It is also a book about honesty and passion, and how that too fuels us. But most of all, it is a book about a multi-layered life. The Harmony of Parts contains some important life lessons, especially when it seems that there will always be individuals who look down on others, whether it be through the lens of homophobia, anti-immigrant sentiment, racial and ethnic discrimination, just to name a few biases. The book ends with John's refrain that he signed off with for more than 45 years.
You can be who you want to be. You can be what you want to be. You can do what you want to do. It's up to you. Learn from yesterday. Live for today. Dream for tomorrow. John Garabedian, be your dream.
This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis, and you're listening to This Way Out.
We are going, heaven knows where we are going. We'll know we're there. We will get there. Heaven knows how we will get there. We know we will.
Amid mounting reports in Australia of a flawed process, outright ballot tampering and fraud, and escalating homophobic vandalism and violence, the campaign over the Turnbull government's $122 million marriage equality postal plebiscite has gotten as ugly as many critics feared. There was even a row this week over a performance by Ally McLamore and the proudly out Mary Lambert of their Grammy-winning Same Love at the National Rugby League Grand Final in Sydney on October 1st that propelled the single to number one on the Aussie iTunes chart.
For all.
Ballots for the non-compulsory, non-binding marriage equality vote started going out in late September. The return deadline is November 7th. While the sometimes inflammatory campaign rhetoric is expected to continue over the airwaves until then, there were multiple reports this week that many voters have already sent in their ballots. The final tally will be announced on November 15th. Religious conservative groups urging a no vote have reportedly spent twice as much as the yes forces on radio and TV ads, but officials announced that the ballot return rate is already higher than expected, and most observers believe that favors the yes campaign. Nevertheless, Dr. John McLoone of the University of Technology, Sydney, has been studying the impact of the six-week campaign on the mental health of LGBT people. He told ABC's The World Today program this week that enduring the ugliness of the campaign for that long may be a challenge for some people.
6 weeks is a long time in terms of social media and in terms of the sorts of things we're hearing being said about marriage equality in Australia. That seems not to be quelling. It seems to continue, or certainly so far seems to be continuing. I think we can put this down to the idea that this is an incredibly emotive and polarizing issue.
Correspondent Barry McKay sat down with a veteran of LGBT campaigning and mediation to get some sage advice on how to survive the plebiscite.
Anthony Venn Brown was a former Pentecostal preacher and author of a book called A Life of Unlearning. Anthony, can you tell me a little bit more about yourself?
Currently, I'm running an organisation which I founded called Ambassadors and Bridge Builders International. And our role is to reach out to our churches, Christian leaders and Christian organisations to educate them about LGBT people, our community and our relationships. We believe that the enemy is not churches or religious organisations or ex-gay organisations, but the enemy is ignorance. We focus on changing that through education, through information and through dialogue. So many of you will know that Australia currently is going through a marriage equality postal survey to determine what the attitudes are within our society. Many people are finding this very, very challenging. Many LGBT people have never experienced this level of vilification in the public arena. Their relationships, their very person being spoken derogatorily about, and of course about our families as well. So being a survivor now for nearly 20 years in this space, very volatile space, faith and sexuality, I prepared 10 little tips that I've found very useful in my journey that I hope will be able to help other people. So the first tip is that the number one priority is your mental health, and that is even far more important than the cause itself. And if you find your mental health being impacted negatively by what's going on, then you need to take responsibility and do something about that. My second tip is to know your triggers. Oh, my God, we've all got triggers. And some people, what I've seen is that they actually don't know what those triggers are, and I see them going off on Facebook. It could be a name, it could be an organisation, it could be an individual that triggers them, but it's really important to be very self-aware and self-conscious and know what those triggers are so that you can manage that much better. Also, it's good to take a break. You don't have to be in the battle all the time. This is not your cause totally. There are other people who are working in this. So you can have a break. Don't just do that because it's good. Whether that be a meal, go for a walk, you know, read a book, just take something your mind off it. The next one, of course, is that some things are best ignored. That's an important thing to remember. I think of the Westboro Baptist Church, you know, God Hates Fags. They were actually an incestuous Christian cult of less than 100 people. But they got international notoriety. Why? Because people kept talking about them. Some people are best left ignored. And recently we had a poster in Melbourne put up which mentioned fags, and that was all over social media. Sometimes it's just best to leave things and not give them any more oxygen. I think another important thing is to remember in this highly volatile space, very emotional, is to not turn on the tribe. Because there are people who will do and say things that maybe you disagree with, but this is a time when we really do need to stand together. Number six is that there are some positives out there that are worthwhile promoting. You know, not all Christians are nasty. Not all Christians are against gay and lesbian people. And so there's wonderful things that you can promote as well, which are very positive. Name calling. I think name calling is such a childish behaviour. And it's so easy to call someone a bigot, a homophobe, a hater. And that may be what they are, but just steer clear, because that's really very childish behaviour. And another thing I think is important is to don't poke the bear. You know, the bear's a bit angry out there. I did that the other day. All right, yeah, I make mistakes as well. And somebody had spelt something incorrectly, and what I did, they spelt heresy incorrectly, and I corrected them on it. But what I was doing was actually poking the bear. Unnecessary. It only reinforces people's already negative view of us. Number 9 is wear clean underwear. Very important. Did your mother ever say to you, like, have you got clean underwear on before you went out? They say, because if you have an accident and you've got dirty underwear, it reflects badly on the family. And so whenever I speak, well, you know, when I'm doing something in social media, when I'm speaking in an interview, on the radio, TV, wherever, I always remember I'm not just speaking about me or on my behalf, but I'm speaking on behalf of the tribe. So keep that in mind. And then the last thing is, don't lose your sense of humour. Please. I got too intense. I got too serious at times. It's good to have a good sense of humour. Some things need to be laughed at. Go out with your friends. Have a good night. Do lots of laughter and it will relieve the pressure.
Thank you, Anthony. Just wanted to ask you, what sort of things have you been observing on Facebook and on social media that are reflecting the level of distress that's out there at the moment?
Look, I think that what I've been seeing, Barry, is just a repetition of what people have been saying for ages, is that, you know, homosexuality is a sin, this is unnatural, this is not what God wants. God created a man and a woman, you know, Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. There really is nothing new out there that's being said at the moment.
How are people reacting, though, people, LGBTIQ people?
There's a whole variety of reactions, Barry. Some people are being very, very aggressive and giving it back to people. Others are speaking respectfully. People are disagreeing respectfully. Some people are responding intelligently. Some people are responding emotionally. There's a whole spectrum. But I know that it is impacting people.
Anthony Van Brown, thank you very much. I'm Barry Mackay here in Sydney for This Way Out.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week's program material came from Jessica Andrea and John Dyer V, produced by Steve Pride, Janet Mason, and Barry McKay. Art Garfunkel sang Wo Ya Ya, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Alicia Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KGNU, Boulder, Denver, Fort Collins, and Ward, Colorado, 5KIX, Kangaroo Island, South Australia, WOZO, Knoxville, Tennessee, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. There is, according to Gabriel Rockhill, a contemporary infatuation with democracy. The right is for it, the center is for it, the left is for it. Everybody claims to be pushing for democracy or a more robust version of it. Some locate the origins of Western democracy in ancient Greece. Some trumpet the U.S.'s role today in promoting democracy abroad. Others complain about anti-democratic tendencies in this nation. The discourse around democracy is deafening, but is it productive? What do we ignore, what gets neglected, when our focus is on the best form of government? To the extent that the term democracy masks certain injustices and inequities, should the left have any reservations about deploying that concept, about using it to guide its strategies going forward? Gabriel Rockhill calls a lot into question, including our historical understanding of democracy, in a new book. It's called Counter History of the Present, Untimely Interrogations into Globalization, Technology, Democracy. Gabriel Rockhill is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Villanova University, and he directs the Critical Theory Workshop at the Sorbonne. When Gabriel joined me recently from the Villanova campus, I asked him, how much value is placed on democracy in the contemporary era?
Well, I think that if we look at the history of both the term and practice of democracy, we see a very clear set of developments. And one of the most significant of them is that there has been, since approximately the early to mid 19th century, a massive valorization, both in the political sphere and the intellectual sphere, of democracy, or at least what's referred to as democracy. And I think that an easy comparison to kind of highlight the historical contrast is that if you go back to the ancient Greek world, which many, I think problematically, will point to as the kind of origin or source point of democracy, many of the intellectuals at that point in time or the philosophers were quite critical of democracy and raised a series of important questions regarding it. If you juxtapose that to the contemporary moment, one of the remarkable features, particularly of the latter half of the 20th century, is the extent to which intellectuals across the political spectrum, and not only intellectuals, of course, politicians, economists, political scientists, etc., are in favor of something called democracy. Now, of course, there's a debate over what exactly democracy means, how people understand it, etc. But it tends to operate as something akin to a value concept, meaning that regardless of its precise content or what it purports to describe, the authors using the term democracy are largely using it to refer to something that they find to be positive. These positives can be so far apart that they're actually opposites. But nonetheless, I think that that's one of the things that operates as a kind of unifying ideological constellation around the terminology of democracy today. One of the ways in which democracy operates politically is that you have regimes like the United States and other so-called governments founded on parliamentary democracy, or what's called representative democracy, that present themselves as being democratic and, in fact, tell world historical narratives of the extent to which they have defended democracy, supported democracy, and are the torchbearers of democracy, while at the same time being invested in a worldwide onslaught on the power of normal, everyday, average people. The United States stands out in this regard for the extent to which it has sought to uproot a whole series of democratic endeavors around the world through coup d'etat, through direct invasions, through the destabilization efforts of various democratic governments, the overthrowing of leaders, etc. And much of this I detail in the book itself. At the same time, you have those who are extremely critical, for instance, of U.S. foreign policy or other contemporary so-called democracies, who nonetheless lay claim to the same value concept. You see this around the terminology of radical democracy. You see it a lot on not only the liberal left, which is largely in bed with the value concept of democracy, but also on the hard left. And so one of the things that's quite interesting about the contemporary democratophilia, if you will, is that it spans a very wide political spectrum and includes those who radically disagree.
How much of the talk about democracy is directed at the future, at something to come?
I think that one of the ways in which the modern value concept of democracy emerged was precisely in relationship to a kind of political theodicy in which...
And what is a theodicy?
Well, a theodicy is the kind of religious belief that in spite of any of the evils that might exist in the world here and now, there is a future that is bright and promises much more than what has been delivered in the present. And I think that we see this again and again in the last 150 years or so of democracy as a value concept. That is that many will recognize that contemporary actually existing democracy in the present world is insufficient in various ways. There's not reliable representation, enormous swaths of the population don't have the franchise, or in fact democracies or so-called democracies are invested in imperial endeavors around the world in which they're destroying people's lives indiscriminately. But what is usually held up against that is, and this is why I refer to it as a theodicy of democracy, is that even if either the powers that be, or for that matter, people on the left, would recognize that democracy, or so-called democracy as it actually exists, is insufficient in various ways, the promise of the idea remains there, as if what we needed to do was to bracket material realities, invest our hopes in an idea of something to come, and never question the extent to which it's precisely, perhaps, the investment or overinvestment in idea of something to come that justifies the lack of its material realization in the present. And one of the things that I do in the book is I juxtapose precisely this idea of a democracy to come in various forms to the idea of communism, which is a rival idea that has, of course, marked the long 20th century in various ways. And one of the ways in which communism has been criticized and dismantled from certain perspectives is in terms of a discrepancy between ideas and practice. So that the standard political narratology or the narrative that undergirds some of the claims concerning the supposed defeat of communism is that, well, it might have been a good idea on paper, but in practical reality, it was an aberration. So what we see here in the juxtaposition between the idea of communism and the idea of democracy is, in fact, an inversion of forms, in which in one case, in the case of communism, reality or material realities are more important than the idea, whereas in the case of democracy, regardless of the particular material realities that exist, there's always the promise of some idea of something better to come. This is what I'd call the democratic double standard, that in the case of democracy, we can always talk about ideas and the promises of the future, whereas in the case of communism, we have to condemn the material realities of the past.
You assert in your book that what you call the cult of democracy is inscribed within a historical logic that is, among other things, triumphalist. Talk about that.
Well, it's triumphalist precisely because of the ways in which the march of democracy is understood as a kind of linear progress into a future moment or a future era. Some of that, particularly in the contemporary conjuncture, has arguably been collapsed into the present. So there are many that have, you know, Fukuyama, of course, stands out in this regard, but there are many other similar examples of those who believe that the future of democracy and the promise of democracy has actually manifested itself now, and that the best thing that we can do is shore up what exists in the present moment. But this triumphalism is simply a triumphalism of the present in relationship to the past. In that regard, I think that one thing that we need to do, and that I try to articulate in the book, is drawing a parallel between this technico-democratic mission, the idea that there is a kind of manifest destiny of the spread of democracy around the world and an arrival at this kind of promised land, if we're there yet or if it still remains on the horizon, and another idea of a civilizing mission that dominated the long 19th century and was the bedfellow of colonialism and the spread of European imperialism. In other words, one of the things that I try to unpack is the extent to which there's a very strong analogy to be made between the civilizing mission on the one hand, which was the ideological structural trope, if you will, of colonialism, the idea that the Europeans had mission to spread their civilization to undeveloped, backwards, and savage cultures elsewhere and thereby help them toward a better future. Of course, we know what this has meant, which is a massive decimation of populations around the world, the environment, etc. But that this civilizing mission arguably has been repackaged in the contemporary neocolonial era as the kind of technico-democratic mission in which the same basic mechanisms of manifest destiny are operative. It's the Euro-American world, meaning the imperial powers, that purport to bring the lights of democracy, technological development, economic globalization, etc., to the underdeveloped, backwards cultures of the world. And so the triumphalism is not simply the triumphalism of a halcyon idea to come. It's a triumphalism of an imperial project that is subjecting the entire world to the forces of capital that emanate from the imperial centers.
That's Gabriel Rockhill. He's associate professor of philosophy at Villanova University, and we are talking about his book, Counter History of the Present, Untimely Interrogations into Globalization, Technology, Democracy. It's just out from Duke University Press. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. You begin a section of your book, the section that we have chosen to focus on, about the history of democracy, with the statement that democracy as such does not exist. What do you mean by that?
This is a fundamental methodological premise of the book as a whole, One of the things that I understand by a counter-history is an intellectual orientation that instead of beginning with the assumption that there are objects or peoples or activities of the world that have histories that need to be recounted, a counter-history begins the other way around. It begins by recognizing that all of the objects, peoples, activities, values, and representations that we currently have are the result of historical forces and processes of sedimentation. In this sense, then, what I attempt to do in the case of democracy is to demonstrate in some detail the extent to which there isn't democracy in general, such as a concept or a practice, that would then have a particular history that we could chart out, like you tell the life of a human being, assuming that there's an identity to the human being and that that individual would evolve through different stages. This is the kind of biographical model of history that I push back against. From a counter-historical perspective, then, what we need to do is begin by understanding the complex socio-historical conjunctures that produce particular ideas and practices. In this regard, I advocate for what I refer to as an intransitive history of democracy. This is just drawing on the vocabulary of kind of grammatical analysis. A transitive history would presume that there's an object that has a history, such as democracy or republicanism or something like this. An intransitive history precisely begins the other way around by detailing the extent to which there are certain practices that emerged specifically in particular conjunctures that were then labeled or potentially relabeled as democratic in various ways. And so we should not assume that there's a single practice or concept of democracy that cuts across the entirety of history or goes back to some type of mythological origin, such as ancient Greece. In this regard, then, a counter-history is what I refer to as a modality of radical historicism, in which everything is historical all the way down. And this does not mean that it's historically determined. It simply means that what we have currently at our disposition is the result of a broad series of historical forces.
Well, let's take the common notion that democracy was born in the West, and specifically in ancient Greece, and you referred to this a bit earlier. Before we address what you briefly mentioned about the fact that in ancient Athens, there were, in fact, a lot of critiques of democracy, that thinkers back then did not approve of democracy in certain ways. Let's start with the main features of Athenian democracy. What should we know about that political system?
Well, I would say two things. One is that it is very important to identify from the contemporary point of view the extent to which the focus on Athens and on ancient Greece is the result of a history that's about 150 to 200 years old, and it has to do with the consolidation of particular political narratives concerning the birth of Europe. And this should not be lost on us. The attempt to situate democracy in ancient Greece and identify ancient Greece as the origin of something called Europe is a quintessentially modern phenomenon that had to do with the consolidation of Europe as an imperial force in the world. And I could say a lot more about that, but I think that the correlation between the West and the democracy is precisely related to this narrative, and it's one of the reasons it was so important in this project to deconstruct precisely this origin myth. And so more pointedly concerning your question, the second point that I'd like to make is that in ancient Athens, the democracy that was operative was in a small city-state that had about 42 to 43,000 citizens among a population of approximately 250,000 people. So the citizens were a small minority, and there was a natural distinction, natural I put here in quotes, but the Greeks did not, between those who were part of what Aristotle referred to as the koinonia politikae, or the political association, meaning the community of citizens, and those who were not, which included women, children, slaves, medics, which were resident aliens of ancient Greece or ancient Athens. And so in this regard, the very structural composition of democracy in ancient Athens was such that there was a delimitation in which the minority of the population actually could participate in modes of direct governance. It was also a direct democracy. But that being said, the assembly in which all citizens, which is only about 17% of the inhabitants of Athens, could attend and go to the assembly, only 6,000 people would actually fit or could be present in the assembly at the same time, meaning that at a maximum, only about 2.4% of the entire population could participate in so-called direct democracy. This should raise some very serious questions about exactly how ancient Greece operated and why we would want to hold it up as a kind of reference point for direct democracy, radical democracy, what we need today, etc. Ancient Athens was an imperial society. It's one of only five slave societies in the history of the world identified by Moses Finley. And these kind of structural inequalities were absolutely essential to the way in which the so-called democracy operated. There are other features, of course, that are important. The fact that there were no political parties in the modern sense of the term, there weren't structures of representation, there wasn't even a consolidated state as we would understand it. These were small city-states. Religion and mythology played an absolutely central role. Political liberalism was not operative at all, and so all of the projections onto ancient Greece of the liberalism that emerged in 17th century Europe are misfounded. And so one of the roles that this plays in the book is to highlight the extent to which precisely there is not democracy in general that has a particular history. Instead, there are very unique socio-historical and political configurations of things labeled democratic, and we need to understand the specificity of these practices.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Gabriel Rockhill joins me. He is a philosophy professor at Villanova University and director of the Critical Theory Workshop at the Sorbonne. He's written a number of books, and his newest book is Counter History of the Present, Untimely Interrogations into Globalization, Technology, Democracy. So we have this shining example held up by contemporary thinkers, a place where a democracy was born. If we go to post-antiquity, I wonder how long it was before democracy of some kind, of any kind, was back in vogue, or at least spoke of in a kind of approving way.
Well, this is what I refer to in the book as the second major phase of the history of the of this intransitive history of democracy. And I say a phase because I understand this not as a particular epoch in which everything would be unified. History always has a geographic dimension and a stratigraphic dimension, meaning that different strata operative in history. But one of the remarkable things about the narratives told about the history of democracy in the Western world is the assumption that there was a Greek origin and then there was a kind of progress narrative to the contemporary world. But in fact, if we dig into the archive, one of the things that we find is between late antiquity and approximately the 17th century, the concept of democracy becomes is not widely used, and when it is used, it's usually employed in order to refer to something that the ancients were talking about and not something that was operative in the contemporary world. And so there's this enormous gap between the ancient world and then the emergent kind of enlightenment, the broad enlightenment phase of the modern world. And it's only around the 17th century, particularly in circles around Spinoza, for instance, that you begin to see references to democracy that are more positive, but that also refer to it as something that we might want to try to establish today, as opposed to something that is situated in the world of antiquity.
And tell us a little bit about what Spinoza said about democracy and why you write that expressions of a kind of approval for democracy were rare exceptions at that point in time.
Spinoza and the circles that Spinoza operated in was important for being a figure. He did not develop a kind of full-blown theory of democracy compared to at least much later thinkers, but he did index it as something that is worthy of being interrogated as potentially something to instigate or promulgate in the contemporary moment. And this is against a rising tide through the course of the long 18th century in which the intellectuals in Europe, for the most part, began identifying democracy, and there's excellent work on the kind of semantic history of the term on this in this regard, as something that was quintessentially dangerous. And the reason it was dangerous is because it was giving power to the masses, to the people, and it was presumed that the people, and this, you know, some of this is of course true, were uneducated because there weren't structures of education, there were low literacy rates and things like this. And so democracy came to mean through the course of the Enlightenment, with minor exceptions like Spinoza and a few others, mob rule. It meant giving the power to a general population that was uneducated and therefore incapable of ruling. One, because they didn't have the education, but as well because they did not have this is, of course, the Enlightenment presupposition, the leisure time to dedicate themselves to developing the intellectual tools necessary to rule. Now, behind this kind of intellectual critique, there is a critique based on property and a concern for what would happen to the property rights of the ruling class if the general population were truly given power. This is one of the reasons that in the book I highlight the central importance of the so-called founding fathers in the United States, because perhaps better than anyone, they pointed out the quintessential problem with democracy, according to Enlightenment thinkers. That is that if you give power to the people, one of the first things that they will demand is a redistribution of land and wealth. In that regard, it has to be avoided at all costs because it would destroy the very conditions of possibility of governance, at least according to the Enlightenment ideals of republicanism. And those conditions are that you have an elite class that is propertied and has another subordinate class or set of classes that is working for it and providing it the leisure time it needs in order to quote unquote rule them.
So if there was a lot of distrust of democracy in the era of the so-called founding fathers, I mean, can we at least look to the U.S. Constitution for democratic ideas and principles?
Absolutely not. This is one of the other quintessential myths that I dismantle in the book, the assumption that the perfect instance of modern democracy corresponds to the founding of the American Republic at the end of the 18th century. If we read through the archive of the Federalist Papers, the debates at the Constitutional Convention, etc., one of the things that is absolutely clear is that the group of figures referred to as the Founding Fathers were rabidly opposed to democracy because they identified it as a troublesome and meddlesome form that would precisely call into question the necessary conditions of political rule, that is, that there be an elite class and an underclass. There are many examples of this, of course, that I give in the book and I could go into. But what I'd like to highlight is that the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, is in fact one of the major moments of the consolidation of power by the eminent members of the landowning class. In fact, the Constitutional Convention was opened in 1787 in Philadelphia by Edmund Randolph, and he really set the tone for the conversations that were to come, and you see echoes throughout the conversations to his opening claim. He says, "Our chief danger arises from the democratic parts of our constitutions." Here he's referring to the democratic parts of the state constitutions. He says, "It is a maxim which I hold incontrovertible that the powers of government exercised by the people swallows up the other branches. None of the constitutions," meaning again the state constitutions, "have provided sufficient checks against the democracy." This comes back in the comments of Roger Sherman and Eldridge Gerry and others, that the major evil to be avoided in the establishment of the U.S. Constitution is the evil of democracy. And of course, that's precisely what the Founding Fathers did. They did not provide for popular elections, except in the case of the House of Representatives, and their qualifications were set by the state legislatures, which required property holding, as well as excluded women, Native Americans, and slaves. And the Constitution provided that senators be elected by the state legislators, not by the people, and the president to be elected by electors chosen by the state legislators, and the Supreme Court to be appointed by the president. So at all of these levels, those Federalists who are rabidly opposed to democracy succeeded in establishing a constitution that would found the United States as a republic. This is the vocabulary that's used throughout the founding documents, opposed to, directly opposed to, a democracy.
That's the voice of Gabriel Rockhill. He teaches philosophy at Villanova, and he is author of Counter History of the Present. We will take a short break and return and speak more with Gabriel about his really interesting book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Gabriel Rockhill is a philosopher based at Villanova University. His books include Interventions in Contemporary Thought, History, Politics, Aesthetics, and Radical History and the Politics of Art. And he is co-editor of the volume Jacques Rancière, History, Politics, Aesthetics. We are speaking with him today about his new book. It's called Counter History of the Present, Untimely Interrogations into Globalization, Technology, Democracy. And we are focusing today on the section of his book about a democracy and what it means or doesn't mean, and its massive, as he calls it, valorization in the contemporary world, which he he's not calling the valorization in question. That is a fact. But he is asking us to look deeper at the concept of democracy, what it means, what it has meant, and where we might want to go with it or perhaps without it in the future. So to continue with our historical elaboration, Gabriel, you write that in the early 1800s, a reversal of opinion on the subject of democracy occurred. What happened?
Well, one of the ways in which this occurred is that, as I mentioned earlier, the emerging republic in the United States was pitted directly against democracy, and explicitly so, so that all of the founding institutions that we have in the United States are institutions that are rooted in the idea of republicanism. Republicanism is a form of elite rule in which you have a group of few privileged men who are white property-owning men, in the case of the United States, deists as well, and that they are the ones who are fit to rule and fit to establish the kind of parameters by which the country should be run. Now, in the kind of development of 19th century America, one of the things that we see is a move that occurred around the 1820s and 1830s. Largely around, for the first time at least, around the political campaign of Andrew Jackson, which consisted in presenting himself as a candidate for the presidency, as being a friend of the people, an average everyday person, hence a Democrat. And the way in which the terminology of a Democrat or democracy began to be used slowly but surely as of the 1830s in the United States, and you see a similar development in Europe around mid-century, around 1848 in France and elsewhere, was to refer to a form of governance that, in the case of the United States, remained oligarchic. It remained the rule of the few, but it was rebranded and packaged to be presented to the people as being democratic, either through the kind of populist campaigns of particular officials seeking office or through the attempts on the part of the U.S. government to rename itself a democracy. Auguste Blanqui, quite famously and importantly, I shouldn't say famously because he's probably not the most well-known figure, but quite importantly pointed out precisely this problem. He claimed, quote, "Beware of words lacking definition. This is the favorite instrument of schemers. Everyone," this is in the mid-19th century that he says this, "everyone purports to be a democrat, above all, the aristocrats," end quote. This, I think, really sums up what happened through the course of the early to mid-19th century in the United States as well as in Europe, is that oligarchic regimes that were republican rebranded themselves as democracies without actually changing the structural modes of organization of the government. In other words, what we have, and we've inherited this directly in the contemporary world in the United States, is a political regime that established itself as an oligarchic republic, and I would say more explicitly a plutocracy, meaning that those who have power are the ones who are wealthy. It's the rule of wealth. That has this plutocracy has rebranded itself and labeled itself as a democracy in order to better sell itself to the people and convince the general population that the oligarchic plutocrats who have all of the power and all of the resources are in fact there simply to rule in the best interest of the people.
Well, Gabriel, what do you make of the fact that the concept, the idea of democracy has been deployed not just by people in the liberal tradition, people with the liberal worldview, but also radical lefty traditions like the Marxist tradition?
Yeah, I do think that this is a very important part of this story. The tradition of political liberalism is in structural opposition to that of Marxism and anarchism. And that in the 19th century, when Marxism and anarchism emerged, they were very invested in the emerging democratic consensus. Of course, with the big difference being that in Marxist terms, and of course Lenin said this more explicitly than perhaps anyone, there's a distinction to be made between the formal democracy of the liberal regimes, meaning democracies that give power to the people in form alone, meaning they bequeath rights that actually have very little or no substance to them. They don't actually give power to the people. And they juxtapose this to substantive or substantial democracy in which people would actually have really extant political power. Now, in spite of the fact that these differences are there, and I think quintessentially important, the rallying point for both at least traditional Marxists and anarchists and liberals is democracy. One of the reasons that I point this out is that I am not convinced that the central political debate should be about what's called the best form of government. This is a standard question that has haunted significant swaths of the history of philosophy, political theory, political science, etc., with many bringing their contribution to this debate. In my opinion, the question of the best form of government is actually a misguided question, at least for two reasons. One is that in spite of what many intellectuals like to believe, we are actually never in the position of a kind of godlike stance in which you could just bequeath upon a people the best form of government. So even if we were able to identify it, we certainly wouldn't be able to establish it because of the restricted agency that we have in a particular social field. But secondly, the reason that I think that it is a poorly formulated question is that politics is not and cannot be understood as distinct from economics, social modes of organization, values, forms of representation, etc. And to come back to one of the things that we were talking about earlier, purported democracy in pre-capitalist ancient Greece has very little to do with the so-called democracies, which are actually plutocratic forms of republicanism under capitalism in the contemporary world. And so what we should do is undertake a broader materialist analysis of politics in the broad sense, not this kind of purity of the political in which you presume that there's a political sphere that's distinct from other spheres, but instead understand politics as the collective forging of a cosmos. And by cosmos, I mean an entire world of values, norms, modes of social interaction, aesthetic representations, etc., and that these cannot be reduced to very simplistic decisions between different types of rule.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Gabriel Rockhill is a philosophy professor at Villanova University, and his new book, just out from Duke University Press, is called Counter History of the Present: Untimely Interrogations into Globalization, Technology, Democracy. Could you talk more about where the U.S., where you think the U.S. currently stands in relation to democracy and democratic practice?
The United States today is by no means a democracy, and they're a democracy in the sense that, again, I understand this as a kind of it's a term in struggle. There are many different definitions of what democracy is, but by the standard measures, it is not a democracy. And one of the best examples of this is the extent to which U.S. foreign policy and domestic policy has been driven to decimate democratic in the sense of people-based or popular uprisings around the world. I cite the excellent work of William Bloom, who's a former member of the State Department, if I'm not mistaken. He has a book entitled America's Deadliest Export, Democracy. And he's gone through and detailed that the United States since World War II has overthrown more than 50 foreign governments, the majority of which were democratically elected. It's grossly interfered in democratic elections in at least 30 countries. It's attempted to assassinate more than 50 foreign leaders, dropped bombs on 30 countries, and the list goes on and on. In this regard, if you look at the historical record of the United States, what you have is a plutocratic oligarchy that is imperialist and neocolonial, but that sells to the general population through the mass media and the propaganda apparatus that is supported by the deep corporate infrastructure. It's part of the imperialist endeavor. It sold to the general population a whole series of myths concerning, one, the fact that the United States was founded as a democracy, which is, of course, not a fact, as we've just discussed, but also that the United States is on this kind of democratic mission in which it's becoming more and more inclusive of voices from the outside domestically, giving the franchise to women and blacks, etc. We know the standard kind of narratives of progress. But also that, in fact, its imperialist endeavors abroad are an attempt to spread democracy to more or less, quote-unquote, backwards people. All of this shows the extent to which the motif of using democracy as a kind of propaganda term is alive and well in contemporary America. In fact, it's perhaps the single best example of the success of the propaganda machine, because people don't only believe in it, they are libidinally and affectively attached to this idea and find it extremely disturbing that anyone could call it into question.
Yeah, in the context of U.S. foreign policy and foreign intervention, you suggest that it would perhaps not be absurd to allow everyone in the world, or at least millions of people living abroad, to vote in U.S. elections. Why do you say that?
Well, if we look at kind of world history since World War II, one of the things that has happened is that the U.S. has taken over the colonial network of Europe. And it's done it in a slightly different way, where the process of quote-unquote decolonization, which was when the European powers kind of collapsed during and after World War II, and hence withdrew and allowed, in part, some of them were very bloody struggles, of course, but there were movements of national liberation. What the United States did was to go in, and I've done a lot of research on precisely the ways in which the CIA and other covert operations were at work at this point in time, and took over those networks internally, and then propped up various leaders around the world. As I mentioned earlier, there's a whole series of CIA coups, assassinations, etc. And in doing that, established a kind of world hegemony of an unprecedented sort. In this regard, if the United States really wanted to recognize and defend the rights of general people, and I should say not just the rights, the political power of the general population of the world today, then it would seem that instead of invading their countries, dropping bombs, assassinating their leaders, intervening in their elections, etc., that what they should do is give them political power to make decisions concerning the leaders of the global hegemon, because ultimately it's those leaders and the corporate class that functions hand in hand with them that has had the most significant impact on their lives and on their countries.
Right. And I'm kind of reading from your book, these people's fate is largely determined by the actions of the U.S. government. So if democracy is about having an active voice in things that affect you, then let them vote. Let them choose their representatives.
Yeah, I would say that this is kind of – it's a slightly rhetorical question, of course, in the way in which I frame it. I would want to push even further than that and say that, well, shouldn't we consider the possibility that we would give them real political power? And what I understand by real political power is not the power once every 4 years to vote a member of the dominant oppressing class into power for the next 4 years. Real political power is actually the power not to have somebody represent you, but to be a political agent and not have that political agency taken away from you. In fact, it might be worth highlighting in this regard another kind of facet of the book and its analysis of contemporary democracy, because one of my concerns is how democracy also operates as a kind of double-edged sword of sorts. The blunt edge of the sword is used to beat people down and say to them, well, you don't have to worry about your political agency. All that you have to worry about is who's going to represent that agency. So don't be political yourself outside of the system of representative government that is there to represent you. Or an additional example of this is the attempt to convince people that the current form of government is the best possible one, and all we could potentially do is improve it. This I refer to as the blunt edge of the sword, because it's coming down from the powers above us and bludgeoning us like a blunt tool in order to keep us in place. But the other aspect of this sword that is also very important to highlight, and this is what I'd refer to as the sharp edge of this double-edged sword, is that democracy is often used as a term and concept and practice to cut the legs out from underneath certain movements, in the sense that it is a general imperative of contemporary political organizing that whatever organization you're part of should be quote-unquote democratic. And what that usually means is there should be a horizontal mode of organization and that it should be generally transparent, it should be nonviolent, and a whole series of other things that qualify it as democratic. This can, and in my own experience in political organizing, has at times cut the legs out from underneath movements, because it makes them democratic, in quotes, in the sense that the establishment powers would like social movements to be democratic, meaning that if they're horizontal, oftentimes they are rendered powerless in various ways because anyone can participate, including infiltrators, members of the FBI, etc. If they're transparent, it's very easy to orchestrate surveillance over them. And so there's a way in which the value concept of democracy, when it's not thought through in various ways, also can undercut movements. And I think one of the things that's important is to develop different modes of organization that are not beholden to the political and moral coordinates imposed on us from above by the blunt and sharp sword of the democratic consensus.
Well, if democracy as a concept, as an idea, is used, as you say, as a fig leaf, as a way to mask a set of injustices and anti-democratic practices of nominally, you know, of nations that present themselves as democratic, if democracy is used, as you say, to undermine many social movements in the ways you've suggested, if democracy does not, in fact, exist in many nations that call themselves democratic, then what do you think should be done with democracy, done with the term democracy?
I suggest in the book that it is a concept and a term that has been – it's what Blanqui referred to as a rubbery concept, un mot en caoutchouc, that has been pulled and pushed in so many different directions that it is very difficult to mobilize in a productive fashion. And I wonder – this is a rhetorical question. I'm not absolutely convinced of it, but I wonder if we shouldn't set it out to pasture and begin thinking in broader terms, not simply regarding the best form of government, as I mentioned earlier, isolating politics from the broader world, but instead of forms of autonomous ways of norming communities that are not bound up with the idea that our discussions should always be about foundations for politics, the Greek term arche, or about power, kratos, which basically these are the two kind of etymological sources of monarchy, oligarchy, and democracy. But instead, perhaps we should think about something, and this I just reference briefly in the book, like isonomy. Isonomy is an ancient Greek word that refers to the ways in which a community will, through equal modes of interaction, give itself its own norms, meaning that it's not simply about a political mode of organization, but it's about the entire construction of a political, social, economic, aesthetic community. In this regard, we wouldn't have to be handcuffed by references to either the best form of government or to the need to define ourselves as democratic, whatever that might mean. And we could begin taking some distance from a term that I think unfortunately often operates in the contemporary conjuncture as a stopgap for thought. Someone says democracy, it means a good, something that's good. I would like to think through that and not have the kind of moral coding of a value concept hijack both my thought processes and my political engagements, and instead think more fundamentally and act more fundamentally regarding what it might mean to have communities that are not simply defined in terms of this best form of governance and the isolation of the political from this broader field of agency and social forces.
Gabriel, we've been talking about only one of the chapters of this very interesting book of yours, Counter History of the Present. What else do you argue in this book?
Well, the book as a whole proposes a counter history of the present, as of course the title explicitly suggests. And by counter history, I mean two things. One is it's an attempt to dismantle one of the most standard images of the contemporary world. That is an understanding that the world we have inherited in the present moment is a kind of unified world in which there's a global and technological network that links people together, and that there is an overwhelming consensus regarding the best form of government, which is democracy. This image of the world, or this world image, is part of a political imaginary and a historical imaginary. And I go to great lengths to show that both of these are bound up with one another, that we understand politics through understanding history and vice versa. And so I push back very hard against this contemporary world image, and this is some of what we've been talking about concerning democracy. The other aspect of the book is to reconfigure the tectonic plates that undergird our very understanding of history. What I mean by that is I'm not simply saying, well, this image of history is wrong and I'm going to present the right image of history. But instead what I'm saying is that we need to reconfigure our very understanding of history so that we give ourselves different tools for understanding what the quote-unquote present is. And I'll just address this very quickly, but one of the major motifs in the book is the idea that there isn't a single present moment that is the same across the entire spectrum of geographic experiences in the world and across all strata of social existence. So that we need to take into account both the chronological dimension of history, the geographic dimension, as well as what I refer to as the stratigraphic, meaning social stratification. And that if we do that, we cannot tell simple stories of linear progress or decline, for that matter, but we develop, this is what I try to do in the book, an alternative historical order that gives us a completely different vocabulary for understanding what is referred to simplistically as quote-unquote the present. So the book really operates at two different levels at the same time. One is a dismantling of the schematization of the present moment, and the other is a more methodological reconfiguration of the very tools, the intellectual tools that we have for thinking the present so that we can think it in radically different ways.
The book is Counter History of the Present, Untimely Interrogations into Globalization, Technology, Democracy. The author, my guest, is Gabriel Rockhill. He is Associate Professor of Philosophy at Villanova University. You may also want to check out some of his other books, including Interventions in Contemporary Thought and Radical History on the Politics of Art. Gabriel, thanks so much for writing this book and for joining me today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.